Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Yes, sir.
A question I have. I wanted either Dr. Francis or yourself to explain to me. The last couple of years, in my neighborhood, I take a stick and a nail and I go up and down the block every week, both sides of the block now, from one end of the block to the other, halfway around, pick up street. The most vicious criticism I have gotten has been from black folks. The white folks in my neighborhood come up and say, thank you. Of course, I don't let this slide by because some of it's come from my own relatives. And I say, I got a problem with that. You like seeing this trash in here. And I realized over the last couple of years that the trash generated in the neighborhood has been by the adults. The pizza boxes, the wine bottle, the beer cans, whatever the kids generate is just minor. And I live right up the street from a school.
Okay.
I just want to know, what is the psychology that the black people are going to criticize you for doing this?
Well, it might not be just the you picking up the trash. It might be that they might be saying in a way, they might be saying in a way that you are trying to pander to the white people. See, black people, you know, you have to think about different ways that we think. They see you out there. They say, I know what that he's doing. He's trying to act like he's cleaning up the neighborhood. He's out there trying to impress them crackers. See, that's what they'll say. See? Huh? Right. Right. But see, because they are not out there doing it, okay? And they feel a little guilt, but they don't want that guilt trip. So they'll say what you're doing is out there trying to show them up. See, so that the other white people will say, now that's one of the good ones. The rest of them ought to be like that. All right?
Mm-hmm.
See, that could be it. I'm not saying that's it, but that could be it. See? But now, this code is all about what do you do. What you do is if you got time to do that, you just keep doing it. You persist. Pretty soon, somebody else might get an idea at least not to throw the trash down. They'll say, that crazy dude live up the block, he come around with a stick picking it up, so you know I ain't going to make it hard on him tonight. I'm going to take the pizza box on up here, just 15 feet, and put it in the trash. They might do that. They'll get worse? Okay. Well, it could be that they're trying to outdo you. Okay, well. But I'm saying the persistence still has to be there if you got time. Now, not everybody has time to do that. I mean, you're fortunate that you do.
Neely, let me say
yes,
this.
Yes, ma'am. Hold just a second.
That I think that there's a full court press going on in terms of making a very, very destructive and negative image of black people. In other words, every time you turn on the TV, it's some black young man with his head covered with his coat and his hand behind his back. Or by the time Living Color or what is it, Martin, or all of those negative images keep coming and coming and coming, and people are looking at it, thinking they're being entertained, but they're being programmed to accept a very, very negative image. You see, in other words, that acceptance is almost like if you're picking up trash and you should give yourself 1,000 gold stars and 100 A pluses every time you move to do that, and you do keep doing it, but people are saying, no, trash is consistent with my image. That's what's going on subconsciously. And the television, I mean, if you just sit back from the television and look at the negative images, Neely mentioned a few minutes ago about black men with no shirts on. That has just started. They've just started showing, do you see, when you're naked and then the next image is a white man with a shirt and a tie on, you are being demeaned. There was an ad I saw the other day when there was an elderly black man in the kitchen or someplace with his wife. They're older people looking like in their 60s or 70s. He had his shirt all open. Do you see, and the next image that you saw of a white person was buttoned up shirt. See, this is plain all the time. This is a very sophisticated, keep their image of themselves at the lowest possible level. Keep it low, keep it low. And there has to be a counteroffensive, not of yelling and screaming, do you see, but a counteroffensive, like, you know, the bottom line of what Mr. Fuller is saying is that we need to identify ourselves as people who are about the business of bringing justice to the planet. People who are about the business of respecting themselves. And so if we keep talking in that way, you might, you know, meet one of your neighbors in the drugstore or something, and you say, the reason that I keep doing this, I know that some people think I'm crazy, but the reason that I keep doing it is because of what I believe we really are, or what I believe we should be about. Do you see, where you make up your mind, you're not going to get offended because some black person calls you a name. And you just happen, if the occasion comes about, to tell them where you are about, but not in a put-down way. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because this constant barrage, you know, like they say in basketball, I guess, a full-court press is going on. So that at a very deep level, without our being aware that it's happening, is a lowering the level of what it is that we think about ourselves. And it's in the music and in the rap, you know, some of the rap, not all of it.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, June 12th. 2018, so I have been told. We should be here this Thursday, back to normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Workplace neutralizing workplace racism. Looking forward to exchanging views, hopefully helping some folks resolve some problems without creating new problems on the job. But that's Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Audio segments you heard at the top, that was from the Welsing Institute. 25 years ago, to be specific, from the Welsing Institute, the late grandsister, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, the guest that night, they had Neely Fuller Jr. in attendance sharing some views. Conversation started about littering and expanded to black self-respect, which is something that Dr. Welsing talked about all the time, not just when she visited this here broadcast or at the Welsing Institute, but pretty much every time that she had a microphone or an audience of victims of white supremacy, particularly black people, talking about the significance, importance of black self-respect, and talking about how that was constantly being sabotaged and under attack, had to be the necessity of the system of white supremacy to attack black self-respect in a variety of ways, a full court press, as you heard from Dr. Welsing. Thought that would be grand for one component of what we are hoping to address this evening, although indirectly it'll probably impact many of the different topics that we will discuss for the evening. There's one other snippet from that same lecture that took place 25 years ago that I am very excited that I finally was able to find so that I could sound clip, but we'll save that for another time. Our guest for today, talking about excited, glad to have him back with us, one of our most cherished guests, been visiting with us for a number of years. We've talked about a variety of his published work, other articles. You can visit his website, eyesofmaat.com. Eyes of Ma'at, E-Y-E-S of Ma'at, M-A-A-T.com. Visit his website, get more information about his books. You can see his blog, just more details about our guest for the broadcast. If you've heard him before, you can go back in the archives. You can check out when we discussed some of his published works, including The Awakening, OMG, The President is Black, and Reality Check, a manual for the human octahedron and the mystery of melanin. Particularly later on, some of the components of this evening's broadcast, we definitely discussed in Reality Check, but I think some of those bits of information are important enough that they bear repeating, but that definitely relates to what we'll discuss this evening. Always a pleasure to have him on the broadcast, a behavioral neuroscientist, neuropsychologist, professor, author, and father. Joining us live once again on the context of white supremacy, our guest, Dr. Niana Rasayan. Dr. Rasayan, are you with us, sir?
Absolutely. Top of the day. Are you able to hear me okay?
You are crystal, Dr. Rasayan. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Tuesday evening with us once again, sir.
Well, as you know, I'm always honored to come out and share with you my perspective about these strange things. Well, they're really not strange. They're just par for the course in a society that's trying to do what it has successfully done for any number of centuries now to melanin-dominant people throughout the North America and, quite frankly, throughout the planet. So I'm honored to be here, and as always, I will take your lead and share my perspective with you as we move along.
For sure. The website again, eyesofmaat.com. Anything you want to say? I'm sure we might have some folks, this might be their first time hearing from you. Anything they should know about who you are, the work you do, before we get started?
Well, in training, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I prefer to call myself a behavior neuroscientist because my last degree is in neuroscience or neuropsychology, psychobiology. And I only reference clinical psychology because that's where I have my master's. But my doctorate is in behavioral neuroscience or neuropsychology. So they can find out quite a bit about me by doing a peekaboo at my website that you just recently mentioned, the Eyes of Ma'at, M-A-A-T.com, and Eyes of, you know, your Eyes of Ma'at stuck together. They can find out quite a bit about what I stand for and what I believe in that website. You hear me sounding funny because I was actually burning a tremendous amount of incense, and I just stopped because I know we're going to get into some issues that are going to basically tap into the ancestral spirits and tap into what's going on this planet with the loss of life, and tap into what's going on with this planet with the incredible widespread paranoia that's throughout the planet now among vanilla brothers and sisters, i.e. Caucasian people. So I'm just toning down this incense, but I had too much in this room that I'm in, and I burn things like this for several reasons: to let the ancestors know they're welcome, to keep my vanilla brothers and sisters who are practicing everything they possibly can on the planet right now to destabilize African-American people. I shouldn't just say African-America. I should say melanin-dominant people throughout the world. So, again, they can find out whatever they like to find out about me by doing a peekaboo on my website, and that's about it. I drum to stay focused. I play chess with my computers on a regular basis, and as I told you before, you've been doing a tremendous amount of yoga. I've been practicing Raja Yoga now for probably about 35 to 40 years. That's about it.
Eyesofmaat.com, context of white supremacy with Dr. Niana Rasayan. We've talked on the broadcast before, sometimes critically important to get perspective from folks who might have been around a little bit longer to just see some of the things that can happen. You can see cycles in certain things can be, as I said, critically important. Dr. Rasayan, you were alive, old enough to be aware of things, paying attention in 1972 when the popular blaxploitation flick Superfly came out. Is that correct?
Absolutely, my brother.
Can you?
No doubt.
Can you kind of tell our listeners the impact of that film and just putting it in context in terms of what was happening on the planet in 1972 when this film came out and what was its impact? Why has it had such resonance throughout the last, what is we're talking about, 40 years now?
Oh, no doubt, brother. You're talking about 72. You're talking about 44, 45 plus years. You know, actually, that was during that period of time when we were dealing with what they call black exploitation movies. And I'm thinking, was his real name Ron O'Neill, Superfly?
Yes, sir.
But be mindful that his character at that time, Ron O'Neill was his name. And he was, they used to call him, they call him Priest, you know, Youngblooded Priest, right? And he was actually, he was actually trying to get out of this drug business by getting himself at that time what he thought was $1 million to get him out of that lifestyle. But I think Curtis Mayfield, I believe, did the soundtrack for it. And a lot of people have samples from Superfly in those days. But unfortunately, at that time, heroin was all over the place in Washington, D.C. That was the trailing end of the Vietnam War, and that was during the time of the Watergate. So black people were struggling like you wouldn't believe with drugs. And one of the primary ways that a lot of African-American men that did not, quote-unquote, have probably, 5 to 10% access to work at the post office, they were on the corner dealing drugs. And some of them were running little small enclaves or had a small stables of women doing prostitution because America was so incredibly racist. So African-American men that were coming back from the war and that were trying to navigate racism in America, a lot of them found themselves trying to be drug dealers. And Superfly represented the epitome of the quote-unquote successful drug dealer, which was sort of like a prelude to what most people may recall today when they look at New Jack City and the character that was played by Wesley Snipes. But unfortunately, that reality was if you wanted to do well in America and get paid in America, you had to be a drug dealer. And Superfly represented that character that was doing really well in the drug business. But if you ask me a more specific question, I could probably expand on it because the soundtrack actually put life in that movie, Curtis Mayfield's soundtrack, with the themes and the messages that were in the song. The one that's coming out today, obviously I haven't seen it yet. And I don't really know whether or not it's going to touch on the kinds of things other than what's going on down in Atlanta. So I'm just looking forward to seeing that. So but if you ask me a specific question, I will try and respond to it. But it was clearly one of those classic black exploitation movies. And it typecast black men that were going to be successful in America. Unfortunately, they had to be drug dealers.
For listeners who do not know, the original came out in 1972. It's been remade and it's currently in theaters like right now. You might be able to get off this program and go check it out, get your popcorn and go check it out wherever your city is. I know it's in Seattle theaters up here. But I think it's important, I guess, number one, I was not alive when the film came out, so that's another reason it is important to be able to know some folks who might be a little bit older than you. So number one, I've been told that that film widely distributed, like some people, if you want to talk about films, particularly films that have a lot of black people, sometimes they don't get wide distribution, might be a tough time finding it or getting to it. That was not the case with Superfly in 1972. In fact, I've heard from quite a few black people that that film stayed in theaters. It was just there and there and there. It got held over and held over, like widely available, large numbers of black people and people, period. This was projected worldwide for a long period of time. I guess that would be one. Is that accurate? And if so,
That's absolutely accurate. I would dare say that, unfortunately, even though its message was what its message was, it actually had the kind of following that would be comparable to what a lot of black people engage in today to see Panther. Because black people were so hungry to see a black person, or black male in particular, you might say, do well and beat the system, so to speak, in society. And it didn't really matter to them how he beat the system as long as he beat the system. You follow me? And his character was actually operating out of that kind of rubric of success, if you will, given that success carried the connotation of making a lot of money, having access to the women, fine clothes, and having a really nice car, so to speak. And in those days, black folk were not wrapped up with Mercedes-Benz. It was something like a high-end Cadillac or a deuce and a quarter or what they used to call the name will come to me in a little while. It sort of looked like a Rolls Royce in the front end, but it was an American-made car. So that was what black people viewed as really, really being successful. You know, the television was in the car in those days, and gangster walls, you know, the big white rims on your car, and, you know, big hats, platform shoes, fur coats, long leather coats, carrying probably, you know, like maybe a automatic pistol, Beretta or something like that, and being able to beat the system without getting locked up. And unfortunately, that movie was definitely in the cinema for a very long time. But keep in mind, black people at that time viewed themselves as having very few heroes to look toward. So Superfly, his character, was actually like a hero. I mean, I think a few years later, Shaft came out, and it did its thing for a little while with a soundtrack that was generated by Isaac Hayes. But again, if you focus me, I can be more specific.
Being real specific, my impression, a lot of people feel that, particularly at this time period, so-called civil rights movement, Black Panther Party is still rolling strong, COINTELPRO program is still rolling strong with a lot of black people. You still have a lot of activity directly addressing the system of white supremacy, racism. And then a film like this, I think some people even would charge that this changed the vibration, the energy, where you had a lot of black people who were at least trying to do something constructive in different ways. This switched things to where you had a lot of people shift to say, hey, this is one of the ways that we can stick it to the man. We can sell a whole lot of drugs and make some money. Is that accurate or is that reasonable?
Let me give you my perspective on that. You have to be mindful of the fact that, you know, after 68 or after the 60s, the riots, you had the assassinations. I mean, you had the assassination of Malcolm. You had the assassination of Martin. The Kennedys were assassinated. And then, like I said, in 72, you had the Watergate. I personally think, as I look at it in retrospect, it was diversionary. It was designed to get black people's minds off of anything that related to consciousness and identity. And it did a very good job of it. It did a phenomenal job of it because, again, keep in mind, you did not see black people on television or in the cinema that had any kind of power to navigate the system. So, again, back to my thesis. I don't need to tell you now. The average black guy today that is gainfully employed, a lot of his identity is related to the kind of car that he drives. And that includes the guys that think they're doing well selling in computers or the guys that are educated in academia. You know, Mercedes-Benz and damn BMWs, high-end Benz and BMWs, and a few Audis thrown in there, and every now and then a Lexus. But those cars were cars that people associated with success in America. And just like a horse in the old days, you know, like your car was a signature of how well you had done. The only other major resource or asset that a person would have beyond his horse slash his chariot, his car, was his home. And then that translated into zip code. So back to your point, I'm thinking that what was going on in terms of COINTELPRO and people trying to undermine black people's sense of identity and how they had assassinated our leaders and marginalized conscious black people, I think it was diversionary. And one of the best ways to create distractions for black people has always been the cinema. Short of the cinema, it's comedy. Take today, is it called, what is it? What's the program with Terrence, I think, what's Terrence's name in it, and Taraji? Empire. You follow me? You know, and then there's another one called Power on Show. So they put those same kind of images back in front of us, and then black people assume that the way they're going to get out of the quote-unquote ghetto or the system of racism and white supremacy is to either sell drugs or become a sophisticated rapper and things like that. And they did the exact same thing. And then in the 90s, I think it was the 90s or late 80s, when New Jack City came out with Wesley Snipes. Keep in mind, the thesis again is drugs distract, drugs also sedate, And drugs also, not only do they sedate, they can give the illusion that you are kind of aware, but they blind you to what's going on around you.
Context of white supremacy. Again, now this film is in theaters right now. They refurbished. Do you have any speculation or thoughts as to why they would remake such a film almost 50 years down the road and in the middle of what they call the major opioid crisis?
Well, it's right down in Atlanta. Keep in mind, you got Morehouse down there. You have Spelman down there. You got Clark College down there. And Atlanta, quite frankly, today is a lot like what Detroit was, you might say, in the 70s, or a place like New York and certain places in Chicago before we had all the gang violence that we now have. And Atlanta is the Mecca. You follow me? So when you put that in perspective, Superfly, and I haven't seen the movie yet, had I known that we were going to really specifically talk about this, I would have popped into a cinema and checked it out. But the point is this. I think they're doing it now for two reasons. Europeans are doing it with a double-edged sword. And I don't know who the sponsors are, and I don't know who the executive producers are, but it's being released now with two things in mind. Those two things, T-H-I-N-G-S. One is to make money. They just did Panther, all right? And Panther just kind of like instilled a kind of consciousness in a lot of people and gave people a sense of identity and focus, all right? Now they're doing another movie to take your mind away from being conscious and related to Africa and reminding you back to, like, if you want to get paid, you got to do something illegal. And, again, I don't know exactly what the products are that this hustler is taking care of in Atlanta, but I'm assuming that drugs and gambling and women have to be somewhere in the mix because I haven't seen it yet. And because, as you know, I just got a good handle on it, we're going to talk about it, I don't even really have a good handle on what the themes are. But I guarantee you, clothes, women, getting high. When I say women, I'm talking about getting laid, hedonism, getting high and having access to women and fine clothes. All those kinds of things have to be all over the place in that movie. And I don't know what the score is, so probably it's going to be some rap in the movie. And, again, the theme is going to revolve around probably gambling, getting high, and women, and just people exploiting money. So my thesis is, why now? You just had Panther, brother. Now, somebody's going to tell you they decided to release this because they already had it in the can to be released. But it's being dropped by Columbia Pictures. So my thesis back to the Vanilla Brothers and Sisters, it's two reasons why they want to do it. Two, they want to basically make money, and they want to also dumb down the consciousness. Now, the brother that they have playing Superfly in the movie, all right, is he's taller than this other guy that was in this really classic movie called Mudbound, which was probably on HBO or was on cable network. He's taller, and he's the one that's in charge. You know, he's a handsome brother. He's tall. He's probably sharp, and he's probably, you know, the kind of guy that a lot of women will look up to. And, again, I don't know exactly what his main character is actually doing, but I do know these things, for the most part, are designed to make money, redirect the consciousness of people, and sort of reduce black people to another state of being intertrained, i.e. entertained, and intertrained. They retrain them to think about things that are not necessarily positive and productive and beneficial to the community, but it just impress upon them that, hey, it doesn't matter. As long as you're getting paid, you have access to the women, you can get high, you can get laid. I think that's going to be one of the messages in the movie.
Context of white supremacy. I have not seen the film, do not intend to see the film. I read the synopsis and review. I mean, it's Superfly. How far could they deviate from the original? From what I read, they went according to the blueprint. Black person selling drugs, disgruntled about having to do that and hopeful to get out, which is a part of the original one. Ron O'Neill's character, he does want to get out, but I mean, he is selling drugs and you see him doing cocaine. I think lots of black people, I think if we have folks out there, you could talk to your parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles to ask them about when this film was released, if they saw it. What type of impact? Did they know people who were trying to dress like the main character in the film? Did they know people trying to get the type of Cadillac that he had in the film? Did they know people who were growing their fingernail? Because I think he does cocaine from his fingernail in the film. Did they know people that were doing that? Because I've heard lots of stories from people that were alive at that time that is exactly what was happening. And that sounds like exactly the sort of behavior that whites would want us, that racists would want to promote, exactly what you heard from Dr. Welsing in terms of, this is how I want black people to think of themselves, this is how I want them to behave, thinking of themselves as trashy, drug addict, criminal type, continuing right on up with Empire and Second Release today, with so much.
Yeah, but Gus, let me say this. Gus, may I say this?
Absolutely.
You know what's also interesting? Now the brother is brown, but check this out. I know you know, you're old enough to know, hair texture is an incredibly unique calling card or signature of identity among African Americans living in the United States. Everything from sisters putting tracks in their hair to sisters locking. But locking is different than sisters putting tracks in their hair. But this brother, his character, he doesn't have the typical kind of grade of hair that you usually associate with African American men. His hair is just kind of like an old school high-end process or conk like Malcolm had. So that's another signature of what they want to do around identity. And I don't need to tell you, there are any number of black women and black men still saying today on the trains and the metro throughout Washington, D.C., they want to get a brother that's fair-skinned, but they want to get a brother that has good hair. Are you following what I'm saying? So I do know that the way they portray his character, to have that kind of hairstyle or haircut that would be what black people used to refer to as a process or a conk, but it's cut and crop for today's youth. So I guarantee you that's going to move into the scene of guys that are supposed to be handsome and attractive. But keep in mind, the subliminal beneath that whole theme is this brother has bank. He's a hustler. He has the women. He has the cars. He has the power. And he also has that kind of look that racist America would love for African-American people to continue to struggle with. What do you look like? What is your hair like? What kind of car do you drive? I just wanted to point that out.
Critically important point about the hair. Absolutely. That's why I said it's important to have people who are intelligent enough to be paying attention to these things when they happen to scoop out those details. That hair piece is hugely important, as well as Priest's character, not as dark. Not someone with a lot of melanin, if you want to think like a Lupita Nyong'o, a Lil Wayne, or what have you. He's on the lighter end of the spectrum color-wise. I think that all of that are part of the programming in terms of what they wanted to project with a film like that, and the beauty standards, the racist beauty standards that are being projected. With this film being so much about narcotics, both versions of it being so much about pushing narcotics, right in the middle of what whites call this major opioid crisis. So many different aspects of that that I wanted to touch on. We just played a report this past weekend where they were talking about the surge in the number of children going to foster care. Now, they didn't mention race in the report that we played, but all of the people that they were talking to were white. All of the children that they were talking about were white. And just saying that it was tons. They were seeing a huge statistical increase on the number of children that were there, because you have so many white parents that cannot adequately care for their children. You, as a behavioral neuroscientist, do you see this being that big of a problem, that you could have an entire generation where you have a sizable number of children, white children, that have not been taken care of at all because their parents too busy doing drugs?
You know, that also has two major components, because even though I'm a behavior neuroscientist and my whole thing revolves around what goes on with the brain and neurophysiology of human functioning, I still have to acknowledge that the environment is critically important. But Westerners have socialized you that your environment is physical, but your environment is simultaneously spiritual and physical. And Europeans, in my personal opinion, naturally they value their children, number one. But I'm going to share with you two things that are going to make people a little uncomfortable, but I really don't give a damn about their discomfort, because when we start dropping perspectives, I try my best to operate out of the laws of my art, which means that I tell things the way I see things, and the way I see things 90% of the time is anchored on what the research says, which means I try to give you my perspective of what the science has to say. And remember, science is not just restricted to what Europeans tell you is science, things that they can actually count and measure in the physical realm. Science is also extremely important in the realm of spirituality, or the realm where things are intangible that they're unable to measure. Now, let me concretize exactly what that means. The opioid addiction problem that we're having today is manifesting itself at two levels. For example, in the past decade, the first-time exposure to heroin, according to the data sets for melanin recessive humans, is 90% of the people that are being exposed to heroin for the first time are vanilla people. They're white folk. They're melanin recessive people. 90% in the past decade. Now, remain mindful that Americans constitute 5% of the world's population, yet she is consuming 80% of prescription opioids. Now, for some reason, doctors prescribe more opioids for these white folk than they do for black people, ratio-wise, R-A-T-I-O. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that people might not have the right kind of HMO, they might not have health care insurance, and these drugs, they sell for a lot of money. That's one of the reasons why the white folk are now resorting to getting the drugs from the streets, i.e. heroin. So a lot of these overdoses that are taking place on the streets, they are impacting white women and white men at a level that's completely disproportionate to what it used to be a generation or several decades ago. I personally think the spiritual piece behind that is what Malcolm said, chickens come home to roost. You know, Europeans think that they can do all kinds of things to our community, and they don't think that the universe is going to serve them up for balance, i.e. reciprocity. I personally believe the kinds of things that they were dumping into the ghettos with COINTELPRO and what was going on with Noriega in the movie that the U.S. government recently released about Tom Cruise's character delivering drugs throughout the U.S. of A. And I forgot the other guy's name that pointed out that they actually financed several wars for the cartel by selling drugs to African-American people and dropping weapons and buying weapons to take down to the Contras. All those things are tied together. So when I say chickens come home to roost, America really believes that she can basically decimate black and brown people and not have to pay any dues. So I'm saying to you, the universe has dumped the same crap that this government decisively introduced into our communities is now coming back to haunt them in their own communities. And it's haunting them in a very, very deleterious way. It's impacting their women in a very profound way. Because remember, Caucasian women prior to the 80s, they did a lot of work behind the scenes for their men to go to college and those kinds of things. But now a lot of Caucasian women on their own, being independent, you know, mothers, because their men have left them or their men have embraced lifestyles where their men prefer to spend time with other men rather than with women. And I'm suggesting to you that those are some hell of a stressors for a woman to deal with, to be with a man. And now all of a sudden, not only has he dumped her for his career, but probably a third to 40% of them dumped their women for other men. So those youngsters are growing up in environments with no fathers present. And it's so much stress for these Caucasian women, so they do not know how to cope. African-American women have always had to wear three hats, you know, be the mother and the father, and also do all the other things out in the community that the neighbors would typically do for a woman. Black women have always had to do several things at one time. And I'm suggesting to you that this is too much for these Caucasian women. They are entitled, but they have so many things on their plate now, they don't know what to do. So not only are they using drugs, they're committing suicide. And I'm suggesting to you that some of these drug overdoses are not necessarily just a straight-up overdose because they came across a strong heroin. I personally think that some of these overdoses are directly related to people's efforts to want to commit suicide. But again, my thesis, chickens come home to roost. You cannot constantly dump dirt and dung among a group of people and not think that some of that stench is not going to come back to haunt you.
Context of white supremacy. Dr. Niana Rasayan. I tend to be on the very skeptical side about whether or not system of white supremacy is waning, or there could be some possible problems that we could exploit to help us solve this problem with regards to what you're seeing. And even what you said about the suicide rates, they just had that report today where they were saying that the suicide rates, that could be the next opioid epidemic in terms of what people are going to be saying on the campaign. They were saying that that is a huge problem, increasing numbers of suicides, and they related it directly to the opioid problem and white males. That was the emphasis in the report that I read. White males feeling as though there's a problem of some sort, economic problems. Things just aren't looking as rosy for white men these days as they used to. But do you think the opioid problem could be enough, particularly with...
You're breaking up. Oh. I think what? Repeat that question.
Oh, am I still breaking up? Can you hear me?
No, I got you better, not clear. Go ahead.
Okay. Do you think the what they're calling this opioid problem, opioid crisis, do you think it's substantial enough, particularly with the disruption to white children? Do you think it's substantial enough that it could in some way jeopardize the system of white supremacy in the future?
No, I don't think that alone is going to jeopardize the system of white supremacy. Because be mindful, white supremacy is a system. It impacts everything. It's just like you taking a glass of water and just taking that glass of water and dropping a couple of colonies of bacteria in that glass of water and then pouring it in somebody's milk, so it's going to proliferate. I'm suggesting to you that racism is so ingrained in America that racism is basically a widespread metastasized cancer. It's all over the place. And though it may be something that we will look at and want to do research about, I do not think the opioid crisis and the suicide rate among Caucasian men and Caucasian women is going to be enough to actually make a decisive dent in the system of racism and white supremacy. Because the racism and white supremacy, they are so sophisticated in doing what they do that they are comfortable enough creating what I would call a certain degree of collateral damage. Racism does not mind sacrificing a few white folk from trailer parks or working class white folk. They don't mind sacrificing a few of them because they don't even really want them to prosper in the first place. They want them to be those individuals that sort of serve as a barometer to give people something to live towards, like, you know, poor people, middle class, upper middle class. So they want to create an atmosphere to give people an incentive to think that they can get out of the trailer parks, that they can rise above the kinds of things that are inherent a part of a capitalist society that must always have a proletariat or a group of poor people. So in terms of making a dent, no. But I do know that our taxpayer dollars are paying for the Narcan or the Naloxone that many police precincts are now carrying around with them. And some med units in major cities, they put it on board so they can give people a squirt of this little misty vape up their nose, three or four squirts, to keep these people from actually ODing, from overdosing from heroin. So we're paying for it with our tax dollars, those of us that are gainfully employed. So I do not think that the opioid crisis is going to actually make a dent in the system of racism and white supremacy. That's why I pointed out to you that the universe has a way of basically putting things in order. And it may take a long time from our perspective, but the universe doesn't screw around. I'm sure you've heard the expression, don't F with Mother Nature. And things in the universe act according to natural law. And my thesis, again, is though they wiped out so many brown and black people with heroin in the 70s and the 80s, and then they came along with crack cocaine, I'm suggesting to you that those same things that they did to us decisively that were government sanctioned are coming back into their own communities because their families are also destabilized.
Context of white supremacy. One of our listeners, she has called in repeatedly. I think she's made a really important point. She's emphasized it regularly in talking about the language and how we talk about these issues and saying that during the 80s, 90s, when it was talked about New Jack City and Nino Brown, it was crackhead this. They had Pookie, Chris Rock character, that crackhead Pookie and crackhead this and crack babies and crack. Where we're using a street name to talk about this drug when it was affecting black people. Now we're using a legit name for opioids and how we talk about this and saying that that is extremely important in the way that we talk about these two problems. Words have an impact. What do you make of that? It was crack epidemic in the 80s and 90s. Now we're saying opioid crisis.
See, that's back to the euphemisms. You see, opioid crisis carries the connotation that you're talking about a medical condition. You're talking about a health condition. You're talking about something that is not directly related to racism or psychosocial conditioning and or the general environment. You're talking about something that is more akin to neurophysiology. Hence, when we talk about Narcan, you know, it blocks the opioid receptors, so the person won't have so much of the drug in their body. It allows the body to sort of like have a brief moment, a reprieve, to say that the drug is not going to, in other words, it reverses the effect of the drug, so to speak. So they use that language because that language gives them the latitude to say that we are talking about a medical condition. In the 70s and the 80s, you were talking about crime, and you were talking about human character. But now you're not talking about human character. You're talking about a medical condition, which means that anyone can be vulnerable, which basically removes the stigma and the stereotype of this is something that bad people do, or this is something that people do that are just weak-willed, or they are a poor quality or poor class of people, versus what they're suggesting now. You have these middle-class white girls, these middle-class white men, upper-middle-class folk, finding themselves ODing on heroin from the street, and then they say the reason why they're using heroin from the street is because it's cheaper than over-the-counter medications, and sometimes the doctors are not going to renew the prescription. So language is everything, brother. I don't need to tell you. Language is absolutely everything. And the more polished and the more professional the language sounds, the least likely people are going to look at those individuals that have these problems as being from that criminal element or those individuals that are not worth saving in society. Hence the language they use when they talked about our children being born in the 90s and the end of the 80s, they called the babies crack babies, which meant that the baby wasn't a baby. The baby, in fact, was a product of a crime-driven environment. Therefore, that baby is inherently problematic and a burden on society. Are you following me?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's by design, brother. That's totally by design.
Nothing left to chance. When you were speaking with us earlier today, you said that 90% of the folks in the last decade, 90% of the folks that have been exposed to heroin for the first time, these are whites who are using this drug. Even with that statistic, NPR, they had a report within the last 45 days, 2 months, suggesting that there was a growing number of black people who are suffering from opioid abuse. We talked about it on the broadcast. Some people thought that that might have been deception, saying that they haven't really seen evidence of black people, growing numbers of black people using opioids. We did have some people in the D.C., Virginia, Maryland area who were saying that they were seeing evidence that that could be true. Are you seeing any greater numbers of black people using opioids?
I don't think the numbers have actually increased. I think that they're, well, technically, I don't have a statistic in front of me to verify whether it has increased or decreased. That's why they're using the language trends, all right, which means there's probably a pattern. I think that there may be more people reporting it now, all right, but I think that, unfortunately, our people have struggled with this for a long time, and the struggle is, in our case, is more directly related to institutional racism or the system of racism and white supremacy. So there probably is a trend if you take into consideration that you find more of our people socializing a lot more with them. And if you look at the great song stylists and musicians from the 40s and the 50s, almost all of them that were introduced to hard drugs, I want to say all of them, I would probably say greater than 70%, were introduced to those hard drugs through white managers, you know, to tell them, you know, take this and you'll be able to hang a little longer. You'll be able to do this. You'll be able to do that. Because prior to them dumping hardcore drugs on black people kind of cope with a little bit of alcohol. So white folk introduced them to all these other kind of drugs. And I think, I don't know when they made marijuana illegal, but every now and then folk might smoke a little bit of weed, right? But some of these other things, like particularly cocaine, were introduced to our folk, mostly by white folk. Crack, on the other hand, was basically, you know, the poor man's cocaine. So I do think there probably is a trend, but I don't have any data in my head that I've read recently that will speak to that. But I will also submit to you that it's difficult for people of color to navigate society today because the landscape of institutional racism has become more sophisticated, even though it's more blatant in our face now, given that you have the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, creating a zeitgeist or climate to tell the world and to tell various police precincts and various jurisdictions that you have carte blanche access to screw over brown and black people. So people are feeling a little bit more empowered to marginalize and basically demonize brown and black people. So a lot of people are trying to find ways to cope. And unfortunately, that translates into drugs in some instances. And so when you add drugs to alcohol and people smoking marijuana in general to cope, you have a cocktail for chaos.
You mentioned marijuana. Just this weekend, they had a report. This is in Canada. This is not something happening in the States, but still, I mean, it's right at the border. In Canada, they are discussing programs that strictly focusing on whites, programs to get opioid addicts put down the opioids and consume cannabis, particularly edibles, they were saying. They've said that they've found that this can be very helpful in getting opioid addicts, get them cleaned up. Do you see any likelihood of this spreading to the States? And do you have any thoughts on trading opioids for cannabis?
Well, actually, cannabis, the kind that's not really heavy in THC, the kind they call medical marijuana, there are a lot of medical benefits for marijuana, a tremendous amount of benefits. They can help people with depression. They can help people with clinical depression. They can help people with pain. There are a lot of benefits. Like the brothers from the islands would tell you, very Jah's herb, you know. There is a tremendous amount of literature being generated that suggests that everything from seizures to long-standing chronic pain conditions, clinical depression, a variety of mental health conditions can benefit from medical marijuana. You follow me? And the side effects, or the long-term effects of a medical marijuana, or marijuana in general, are not as deleterious as chronic alcohol abuse. So there are a number of benefits that people can merit from utilizing marijuana. But that doesn't mean the person that's just constantly smoking the crap just to cope is going to get those kind of benefits. It just means that that's their way of putting on blinders, if you will. Now, in a different light, you have to remain mindful that a lot of the facilities that are opening up that are providing licensure for people to sell medical marijuana, a great majority of those things are basically made available through the hands of Vanilla Brothers and Sisters, so they kind of make it more accessible or readily available for them to either get the license or the certification or to put up the storefront to sell medical marijuana than they would for people of color. So either way you look at it, man, the system of racism and white supremacy is designed to do what it does. Now, one of the things that would be a negative around so much access to marijuana would be not like the opium wars or what happened in China, but if you put too much of a compound in front of people to cope, that's what people will rely on to cope. They will do that in order to cope. And it's not easy to cope with a society that constantly marginalizes you and makes you feel less than human. So people look for things to cope. And drugs, sex/alcoholism, and religion oftentimes become the classic outlet for people to cope.
Context of white supremacy, I was thinking of, and absolutely, A-plus commentary from Dr. Rossayon. I was just thinking as I lead into my next question, and even before I do that, if listeners, if you have questions you would like to ask Dr. Rossayon, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you have a question, I will get you on the line. But leading in, absolutely, there's so many ways that victims of white supremacy cope with the trauma of white supremacy racism, whether it's cannabis or alcohol, religion, religion of white supremacy, white Jesus. Food is certainly one. And I mentioned the report. I put it on my Facebook page earlier today. It was in the Times. The dangers of belly fat. It says if your waist measures 35 or more inches for women or 40 or more inches for men, chances are you're harboring a potentially dangerous amount of abdominal fat. Now, scroll down. I'm not going to read the whole article. I posted it on my Facebook page. I did read the whole article. It did have a lot of great information in it. Folks should check it out. But a paragraph I'll share says, unlike the cells in subcutaneous fat, visceral fat is essentially an endocrine organ that secretes hormones and a host of other chemicals linked to diseases that commonly afflict older adults. One such substance is called retinol binding protein 4 that was found in a 16-year study of nurses to increase the risk of developing coronary heart disease. This hazard most likely results from the harmful effects of this protein on insulin resistance, the precursor to type 2 diabetes, and development of metabolic syndrome, a complex of cardiac risk factors. And they talk about how this can impact dementia, which I had not even heard before. Just having excess belly fat can lead to dementia. And they were saying direct link, not causation, not correlation, direct link to all of these different health problems. I've been talking about me doing yoga and 55, almost close to having lost 60 pounds. I think that's one of the huge ways that racism, white supremacy impacts all of us, particularly Black people, and being so stressed, either that we end up turning to food to cope with that stress, or not doing some of the other things, getting quality rest, which they talk about in this article, not getting exercise, which they talk about in this article, not drinking water, which they talk about in this article, Flint. They talk about all those other things that impact your overall health and well-being. And I think Black people, we just get excoriated in all of these areas and medical apartheid and just end up being in really bad health. I was thinking not just of myself when I was 270 pounds not that long ago. I was thinking, Dr. Rassayan, when we had you on the program, this is some years back, and you were talking about Lawrence Fishburne. Been doing in Hollywood long, long time, lengthy acting career, all of the projects that he's been in, The Matrix and everything. And you were on the program a few years back. People have seen him in Blackish, most recently, a show I hate. And you said, wow, I was looking at Lawrence Fishburne. And I think this was after his daughter was doing pornographic film. Big controversy. He was very upset about that, rightfully so. But you were saying, wow, looks like Lawrence Fishburne has put on a lot of weight. If people, you know, can remember what he looked like in The Matrix or Boys in the Hood. He was, you know, fit, in shape, good looking Black male. And now he's put on a lot of weight. And you were saying, wow, I don't know what's happening to him, what's going on. But it seems like they might be putting a lot of stress on him. And it's coming out in his waistline. Just can you address how racism, white supremacy does this to Black people's waistlines?
I will, and I want you to give me an opportunity to come back to point out that in this new Superfly movie, there's a lot more violence in it, and I want to juxtapose on that violence in that new Superfly movie compared to the little bit of violence that you saw in the original Superfly, and then how you saw the fighting in the Panther movie, but there was fighting that was geared toward a greater cause versus all of the violence and the shootouts that are going on in the new Superfly movie. So try to help me remember so we can revisit that.
Yes.
Now back to the waistline. Belly fat. Yeah, brother, not only does that belly fat create an atmosphere conducive for your body to, like, literally grow into type 2 diabetes, it sets the stage for you to have everything from colon cancer to what you've already mentioned, cardiovascular disease and also strokes. Typically, cardiovascular disease and high blood pressure and diabetes, they oftentimes run hand in hand. Just imagine them being a set of triplets, if you will. You know, it doesn't mean that diabetes and cardiovascular disease are literally a holding hands, but it means that there is an incredibly high correlation between diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and problems with people's vision and things like that, because diabetes has a way of degrading the vascular system across the board. I'm talking about the circulation of blood, right? Yes, there's a major relationship, because I don't need to tell you, the classic stereotype is around the holidays, particularly a cute little so-called holiday like Valentine's Day, people have a tendency to eat more ice cream and eat chocolate. Now, chocolate actually allows your body to release a lot more endorphins to make you feel good. Now, food also makes people feel good. I don't need to tell you, because that's something that you can do in the privacy of your home. I mean, you can be alone. You can be by yourself. There's nobody around you. But that person that's already overweight wants to have that double slice of cheesecake, or that person wants to have that chocolate, or that person wants to have that sweet tooth, or those two slices of cherry and apple pie, or banana pudding, or bread pudding, all those kinds of things. Because in Ayurvedic medicine, there are some there's a data set that talks about what people crave oftentimes they're missing. And people that oftentimes crave things that are sweet, they're missing love and joy in their life, right? And so when you look at a lot of black people that are always eating sweets and fried foods, they're trying to fill a void in their life. Now, you take diabetes, Native Americans weren't having diabetes until they started eating white man's food. You know, the white rice, the white potatoes, prior to then, maize was a staple in their diet. And a lot of Asians were, you know, rice. I don't mean regular white rice. I mean different kinds of rice, basmati rice, brown rice. All right, Native Americans had wild rice. So when you eat the white man's food, just like they told you in Roots, and I want to be clear when I say the white man's food, white rice, white sugar, white flour. Now back to Lawrence Fishburne. If, in fact, there was going on what the news said was going on, and if, and the narratives that were written said that Lawrence Fishburne was struggling with the fact that his daughter had gone into porno, that's a lot for a father to deal with, particularly if you process the fact that Lawrence Fishburne, individual, gainfully employed, had a decent income, and for some reason, quote-unquote, allegedly his daughter wanted to become a porn star. So that's stress. So when you look at stress, something else happens. Your body releases a class of compounds that can literally stress out the brain. And as a result of that, as you stress out the brain, you want to, when I say stress out the brain, you might feel a little depressed and a little out of it. And what better way can a person cope that's not using drugs or alcohol than with his food? You take your current 45th. He saw these sodas. He saw this bull crap. But I personally don't give a blank about him. But you look at his body type. And you look at some of the professional athletes, when they stop exercising, they start eating their favorite foods, they put on a lot of weight. And the BMI, the body mass index, increases, which is related to your height and your actual weight, right? And also how much fat you might have on your skin when they pinch you at your waistline where your love handles are. So Lawrence Fishburne was probably under a tremendous amount of stress, just like I don't need to tell you. All you have to do is go into any major Baptist church in the United States and look at the ratio of women to men in that church, and then you look at the ratio of women that have a healthy BMI, probably like 19 or below or 20 or below, and women that have 21, 22 BMI body mass index, meaning that they're overweight, anywhere from like 15 to 25 pounds overweight, you're looking at a level of obesity. So add to that a sedentary lifestyle. You have a job that you sit out on all the time. You don't exercise. You have more stations on television now than you have major streets in some small country cities, right? So when you add that equation to it, you're sitting around, you're lethargic, you're in front of a computer, you're not exercising, you're eating foods that are very, very difficult to digest, they're too much sugar, too much salt in them. You're giving yourself a cocktail for strokes, a cocktail for colon cancer, a cocktail for, let's see, general depression, and a cocktail for diabetes. So it's a major relationship between food, because that's how a lot of people cope. Then add to it, people that have compromised incomes oftentimes do not know how to spend their money to buy healthy food. So they'll buy food to make them feel full versus food that is going to sustain them. And that's also related to institutional racism. Because contrary to popular belief, diabetes type 2 is not something that's directly related to genetics. Diabetes type 2 is literally related to lifestyle.
Context of white supremacy death style for many of us in the system of racism, white supremacy. Shout to Dr. Cambon. What's your response, particularly to the last point that you said? Many victims of white supremacy, you know, they say, hey, Dr. Rossian, I am not making a lot of money. I'm not a professor. I'm not an author. I don't have, you know, my whole paycheck. I cannot go to Whole Foods every week to get fresh organic produce, kale and broccoli and celery and carrots and apples. I can't afford that. And unlike Gus, I do not live in hipster Seattle where there is a yoga studio on every corner. They don't have a 24-hour fitness and all these great gyms and everything. I'm stressed. I don't have a lot of free time. I have a job. It's very difficult for me to get access to quality, healthy foods. And it's difficult for me to find the time and get access to exercise so that I can deal with some of these issues. Do you have any real-world practical ways that folks who are in this situation, which is many black people, can address some of these problems?
I'm going to tell you something that I told somebody that I told a person this one time, if you don't live in a neighborhood where you have to worry about getting robbed and mugged when you go outside your house, one of the easiest things for you to do is to get your butt up in the morning, either go in front of your house, particularly if you have some foliage, some greenery, and you can lean over almost at a 45-degree angle, or just take your hands and put them on your knees, lean over and breathe deeply, slowly. Don't do this if you haven't done it before because it may make you faint, right? Heel to toe, tiptoes, heel to toe, like stand on your toes, stretch. Deep breathe, exercise. You study yoga, so you know one of the first things they teach you how to do is breathe. The sun and moon breath, left nostril, right nostril, right? Black people don't even know how to breathe any damn more. They sit in front of the damn television. It doesn't cost you a damn thing to take a deep breath, all right? Unless you live in a jacked-up neighborhood near a sewage plant or a place that processes a lot of products that produces sulfur, all right? You need to get up and breathe. And you can walk around your house or walk in front of your house, and you can walk from heel to toe. Walk. Swing your arms. Walk. 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in the evening, all right, to stimulate the lymph in your body, to stimulate the circulation in your body, okay? So a lot of people, they make excuses. And stop going to damn bed eating a bunch of crap that you know is not good for you. And say, well, I'm just going to eat this, and this is the only thing I've got to enjoy, so I'm going to eat this before I fall asleep. You fall asleep with your damn television on, you're eating crap, you're laying down on it. Your body is not going to generate the kind of metabolic signature, i.e. catabolism. It's for burning things, breaking things down. Anabolism is when things are building up. So when you fall asleep, you wake up in the morning, you should answer nature's calls. But if you're waking up in the morning and not answering nature's calls, you have a sluggish bowel, all right? Anytime you eat, you need to go to the bathroom, all right? You need to move around. So you don't need to have a lot of money. I wouldn't recommend any damn body to try to make a living off going to Whole Foods Market. It used to be called Fresh Fields, even though Amazon has bought them out. The food in there is too damn expensive, okay? You can eat some fruit every now and then, and you don't need to eat no damn three times a damn day. You can have a little snack around midday or a little breakfast in the morning and have a real meal a little later on. Now, there are a lot of people that make fun of some of my Latino brothers and sisters because they have beans and a lot of things, and sometimes people have rice. You can get a lot of protein out of legumes and beans, all right? And there's no shame in doing that, right? And if you prepare them right, you haven't got to worry about being flatulent. That means full of gas, all right? You have to be mindful of the fact that your body was not designed to process the same kinds of foods that vanilla brothers and sisters eat. For example, potatoes all the damn time is not going to be damn good for you if you're African-American. Nothing wrong with you eating some damn yams, i.e. sweet potatoes. There's nothing wrong with you getting some chickpeas, so-called garbanzo beans. There's nothing wrong with you having some almond butter. There's nothing with almond butter similar to peanut butter. There's nothing wrong with you having some tahini, which is made from sesame seeds, all right? Black people have been socialized to think that they have to have meat at every damn meal, which is one of the worst damn things you can put in your body, particularly if you do not know how to prepare it, i.e. broil it or bake it, okay? And to prepare your vegetables in a wok or just a little bit of olive oil in a skillet. We don't even know how to cook anymore. Back to my thesis. We've started to eat, and we're continuing to eat the white man's food. The white man's foods are designed to take your butt off the damn planet. That's why they tell you white sugar, white flour, white salt, that shit will kill you. It'll do it slowly. Are you feeling me? So it's no excuse for you not to get up and move around a little bit and stop parking your butt in front of the damn television every time you want to look at something and stop eating just before you fall asleep. All that crap tells your colon, and it tells the rest of your body that you don't have a lot of respect for. Now, we can be real specific about things that people can eat and things that people can do, but I just told you about getting up, breathing, right? Walk around a little bit. Move your arms. Stop sitting on your butt all the damn time. When I say sitting on your butt all the time, you come home, you sit down, you have a job, you might work on a computer. If you're not moving around, you're telling your body you don't want your body. Anything that you value, you use it. You can have the finest car in the world, but if you don't crank that bad boy up every now and then to put it on the freeway, it's not going to drive well. Are you following what I'm saying? You have to move your body. Your body is designed to ambulate, to move around. Now, here is a classic secret that a few people may know over 40. Classic secret. One of the best ways to have a dynamite caloric burn, particularly if there's somebody that you truly and genuinely care about, get your love action on. You can burn a whole bunch of calories being passionate, sharing love with somebody that you care for. I don't mean going in there for another 90 seconds or another 3 minutes. I mean get your endorphins surging, let the person know you care for them, they care for you, spend some time moving around, doing a few things. You will burn some calories. You'll also increase your heart rate. All that's good for you. Another thing I want to tell you that a lot of people don't want people to know, in the United States, about 75 to 80% of all our water is fluoridated. fluoridated water will basically undermine the elasticity of your vascular system. That means that it can make your arteries get hard a lot quicker. Fluoridated water is correlated with early onset of Alzheimer's disease. And I know a lot of people in neuroscience may want to debate with me about it, but those are the probably people that work for big pharma, major universities, and they're afraid to say it. Tap water, straight out your faucet, that's fluoridated and has been basically kissed with chlorine, that crap will give you brain damage.
You're in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. Where do you get your water?
Unfortunately, I buy it. And the vast majority of the water that I drink is called Amelia's water, all right? It'll probably go up like I don't know what, depending upon how many of your listeners listen to it, all right? Deer Park is an acceptable water. But you don't want to buy water that's in, like you go in and buy a liter of water and you get like maybe 24 liters of water in a packet, because there's too much plastic being dumped back on the planet. You want to buy gallons or 2.5 gallons of water, and you want to get like the number one rated plastic, and you don't want a lot of bubbles in the water. Now, you can get a Brita if you want to have a Brita, filter your water. But if I was drinking water out of the faucet, I probably would boil it, even if I did use a Brita or a Brita water filter. But I don't drink water out of the faucet. I haven't had any water out of the tap since 1971. And that's a fact. I'm right here for myself, I know. Let me tell you something else. Check this out. If you were to take some tap water, you could have a porcelain or a Pyrex. Ideally porcelain or Pyrex. If you were to take tap water, and, you know, to make your tea and you take water out of the faucet and you put it in your kettle. After you fill that kettle probably about, let's say, 10 to 12 times, you'll see a sediment in the bottle, in the bottom of that porcelain or Pyrex kettle. There will be a little film built up in it. That's coming from the water. And if you have an aluminum kettle, you could put your finger in. Not only would you get little particles, you could feel it between your fingertips, almost like salt. Where do you think that crap goes when it gets inside of your body? So I'm telling you, brother, if you were to just read a little bit, I mean, Braggs, B-R-A-G-G-S, or I forget, maybe that's his name, has a little pamphlet about water. Man, tap water, keep in mind, the human body is at least 70% water. And for people that think that they know science and metaphysics, the ratio of water in your body is directly proportionate to the amount of land on the planet for the your carbon-based life form. So the solids in your body are proportionate to the amount of water on the earth. In other words, the land mass on the planet is comparable to the solids in your body. And the water in your body is comparable to the water on the planet. So you're basically about 70% water. And your brain is damn near 85% water, all right? And your brain runs off a special class of fuel called glucose, right? And the glial cells in your brain are the parts of your brain that allows your brain to maintain its youth / elasticity, and its incredible ability for something called neuroplasticity, it's sort of like regrow or resprout itself, right? You're drinking tap water on a regular basis, eating white sugar, white flour, too much salt in your food. Man, you're on a slow motion ride to get yourself brain damage and cardiovascular disease and colon cancer. Fact, not my opinion. Look it up, Google it, Bing it, Yahoo it. By the way, the Vietnam War was also directly related to controlling rice, because rice was the primary staple that Asians and a lot of people in the world, they use. People eat rice all over the world. Rice is a staple. Right. You follow me? So you control the people by controlling their food supply. I don't need to tell you, you can go into any major city, and if you ask the average kid that's in an urban environment between the ages of probably about 7 and 10, take a lot of the average kid of color. If you ask him what color bananas, he'll tell you they're probably dark yellow to brown. You ask the average kid from the diaspora, the island, they will tell you bananas are probably green and yellow because they see them in their natural state. By the time kids see bananas in some of those little small stores in the city, they're brown because of oxidation. They no longer are yellow. You feel me? So what I'm getting at is, we have what they call food deserts in the city. So people don't have access to fresh food. So the result, they eat a lot of things out of cans, which have too much sugar and too much salt in them. You feel me? Now, some major cities, they actually have little food islands where people grow a little patch of food here, a patch of food there. That's where the war is being fought, my brother. It's being fought. The greatest tools of destruction to impact people of color throughout the world, not just the United States, are water, food, and music. Water, food, and music. I don't need to tell you about continental Africa, all of the problems they have with water there, all right? But if I were to tell you about a major city, man, people can't afford to be buying no damn bottled water. So they're drinking water out of the faucet. And if you can't afford to buy bottled water every now and then, at least be smart enough to get yourself some of those big clear glass bottles, all right? Run that tap water. Let that tap water sit in the sun for about 3 days. And you let that tap water sit on a glass container in the sun for about 3 days, you go outside and look at it, particularly at that glass container will hold 2 or more gallons of water. I guarantee you, you look at that water after about 3 to 5 days it sat in the sun, the bottom part of that water is going to have something in it that looks like sediment, all right? And it will not be as clear as the top part of that water. Are you feeling me? Because there are particles in that water. And you can look at any map online and find out which states fluoridate their water. California and Nevada probably don't fluoridate their water as much as people do in major cities. And fluoridated water with the chlorine added to it, they tell you they put that in the water to, you know, to kill different types of bacteria and things like that. Of course they do, because the same damn water that's running out of your faucet in the kitchen is the same damn water that's in that porcelain bowl in your toilet. Exact same damn water. Don't think those pipes are doing calculus when the water is being run to your house on the main line that's coming from the county or the state to your home. The water does not come to your house and say, oh, by the way, this water is straight for the toilet. Oh, by the way, this water is straight for the faucet. It comes in, the same damn water. It just comes out of the faucet in the kitchen, and it winds up in the toilet in the bathroom. It's the exact same damn water.
Context of white supremacy. Mentioned Flint earlier. Our guest, Dr. Niana Rasayan. The just importance of eating correctly, sleeping correctly, getting that exercise, drinking water. Even the point that you said, you know, certainly you got lots of people they cannot afford to get, you know, fresh spring water delivered to their residence, or, you know, to go to the store yourself and, you know, buy a few gallons of water every other day. Certainly there were lots of black people in the Flint area. That is exactly what they said. Once they cut off the free water deliveries to people there, there were tons of black people that were on the news saying we cannot afford to go to, you know, Costco or wherever you're going to go. And pick up gallons of water every other day. And they need way more of it because they need it for showers, bathrooms, everything. Just, and again, I can point back at myself as being someone who did not drink enough water, did not exercise, did not eat the correct foods, didn't sleep correctly, 270 pounds, lots of work had to be done. And I, again, lots of black people all over the world end up in that position just as a result of stress and everything that we've been talking about, or Dr. Rasayan has been talking about for the last 20 minutes. I'm just saying, I think it should be something that is a core aspect of counter-racism, both in terms of if we're having children, part of your parenting, that, hey, racists, they intend for us to be in really bad health, eating bad foods, fast foods, greasy fried chicken and all that, not drinking water at all, just drinking sodas and nonsense. They intend for us to be in bad health. The Hate U Give, for folks who remember that book, young adult novel, bad food every other page, Cheetos, potato chips, pepperoni pizza, all this nonsense, and they're supposed to be upset and fighting against racism, white supremacy. Wrong. You're going to have heart disease. You're going to be way overweight and dealing with all of your medical complications. You're going to have way other more pressing issues than dealing with white supremacy, racism. Just really emphasizing making that a critical aspect of white supremacy, or in terms of black people. Started off with Dr. Welsinger talking about black self-respect. A critical component of black self-respect, how we think of ourselves, should be in what we eat, getting water, sleep, exercise. You said you started off the program, Dr. Rasayan, you said 35 years you've been doing yoga?
sit right at 40. I said Raja Yoga. Raja Yoga doesn't always mean you have to do what they call asanas, the actual positions. You know, people think they got to get in lotus or semi-lotus position. A Raja Yoga is basically a combination of basic things that you do to basically optimize your vascular system circulation and keeping your mind in a state of not perpetual relaxation, but being mindful of how to practice the African axiom of I am my brother's keeper. You know, it was a vanilla guy that upset me about 3 nights ago because he actually walked up to me and asked me, could he take a picture of the plate of my car? And one of my cars, the plate is I am you. And I was concerned because he doesn't live in the same state that I live in, which means that in his jurisdiction, he could very easily get that plate, you know. And I am you means I am you. So I am my brother's keeper. And, you know, you used to tease me about me calling vanilla brothers and sisters my brothers and sisters. We're all part of the human family. And race is a political construct, and white folk have used it to their advantage. It basically came out of politics. All humans are part of the human family, and we all Tellurians that live on the planet Earth. But there are variations of humans on the planet directly related to how close they live to the equator and how close they live to supplies of water, excuse me, near the equator, and what kind of food sources they have will determine what their musculature, their phenotypes will be mediated by what goes on in the environment. Over a period of generations, or sometimes people will say not just centuries, but a few thousand years, will determine what you actually look like. So I've been practicing Raja Yoga, which is considered to be, I'm not saying it because this is what it is, but the king of yoga is the Raja Yoga, you know, versus Kriya Yoga, certain types of meditation yoga. I've been doing it for like about 38, 40 years, as a matter of fact, because I found it necessary that when I got an understanding of how crazy as my vanilla brothers and sisters are collectively as a people, not the ones that might be my isolated acquaintances or associates, but collectively as a people, that in order to cope with the pathology, I needed to have a, you might say, a higher form of consciousness always engaged to navigate this landscape of racism. Because otherwise, I probably wouldn't be on the planet. Because I probably would have been involved with homicide or some shit, navigating how crazy people are, because I had an opportunity to live in the South for about 14 years. So when you look at racism, if you don't understand your body, then your body is going to be dumping a lot of free radicals in your body. You know, that's like molecules running around like a wild Pac-Man, you know, just tearing up cells in your body. And your body is going to have your immune system compromised on a regular basis because the cells are going to be impacted by a little unique class of teeny tiny proteins they call cytokines, and then there is a class of hormones or stresses that relate to inflammation, which can also be cytokines and cortisol. I don't want to get too technical, but the point is when your body is stressed, your body will release certain compounds in it, and those things can basically kill or basically undermine the viability or the level of functionality of your immune system. And stress is a major degrader of a high-functioning immune system. So Raja Yoga sort of like gives me a reality check on a daily basis. It's like if you were to go into a place and let's say you bump into a bona fide old-school redneck, you bump into a state trooper, you know, he got a chip on his shoulder, he's also packing a 40 caliber on his hip, you know better than to say, come on, man, you know damn well I didn't do anything, so why you pull me over? You know, to say, top of the day, officer, how are you? Driver license registration. And sit there and be quiet till he asks you something. But you don't learn how to do things like that by just being a person navigating life. You have to be mindful of what you've seen that happens to your people, and you have to be mindful prior to the internet. Richard Pryor did a joke about the white guys that were driving and they were drinking and the policeman pulled them over and they were driving and drinking and the white guys just started telling the policeman about, hey, we're having a party. You know, you want to come? Hey, you know, that's a shiny badge you got on there. You know, and then he said, driver license and registration. Sure, you know. And so, like, what's your name? Hey, we're having a party. You're welcome to come over. Whereas the black person, though, to be quiet, put their hands on at the side of the car so the policeman can see them, and automatically they get a little nervous. Because they know they've been drinking a little bit. They're not going to try to converse with the policeman because he's going to smell the alcohol in my breath for the whole 9 yards. But the white guy, like the policeman, they get out of the car, can you walk backwards? I don't think I can do that right now. Maybe I've been drinking a little too much. Do you ever drink? See, we know better than to do that because the put policemen on, tell us to shut up or to lean on the hood of the car. And I'm toning the joke down, but I'm trying to say to you, even though they joked Bill Cosby around for the longest, but after the Cosby Show, a different world came on. And a different world really represented the world that black people live in. We live in a different world. And the world that we live in is a world that operates out of the system of racism and white supremacy. And when you're conscious, you understand that. It doesn't matter if you graduated from Yale or you went to West Point. It doesn't matter. You're still black. You're still African. And when white folks see that melanin in your skin, they claim they cannot differentiate a child from an adult. You understand? You're a woman from a man, depending upon the way she wears her hair or how tall she is. When you are black or African-American running around in this melanin-dominant skin, Caucasian people have been socialized to think that they can treat you less than human. And you have to know that. Because if you don't know that, you can wind up with a quick eulogy that you won't hear.
Context of white supremacy. Folks have a question. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Make sure I do not forget. You requested that we make sure we rewind. You wanted to make sure to contrast the violence that's in the newer Superfly with the relatively minor violence, graphic violence that was in the original that came out in 72.
Yeah, let me just touch on that right now. Because I haven't seen the movie, I did do a little bit of reading about it. And, you know, I don't like to talk about things that I haven't seen, but for them to actually generate a narrative about it obviously points out that that clearly has to be one of the themes or a pronounced set of scenarios in the movie, right? And they point out the fact that this guy is basically trying to do what Ron O'Neill's character did in 72. Remember, he wanted to get out of the drug dealing business and get $1 million so that he could leave Harlem or leave New York to sing with his lady and start a new life. The same theme is running in that movie. This guy is wanting to basically get out of the business and want to go off into the world and kind of like retire and live the good life on a luxury yacht. And you know the thing about yachts, shit, a luxury yacht can cost you shit anywhere greater than $10 million easily, right? So he wants to move into that lifestyle. But I understand there are a lot of violent scenes, scenes in when guys are having shootouts, right? And there was a body count that's jumping off, you know, like the shootouts here, shootouts there, and so forth and so on. So when you put that in perspective, all of these shootouts, that feeds back into the issues of the black-on-black crime. It also feeds back into the issue of people in the neighborhood fighting over a slice of cherry pie rather than the orchard where the cherries are being grown in the wheat field where they grow the wheat. So you're fighting over a slice of cherry pie, and you think you're getting over. So they are feeding that theme of black folk killing each other over crumbs. Are you feeling me? And because I wanted you to be mindful of the fights that you saw in the movie Panther had to do with I think his cousin, T'Challa fighting his cousin. I forgot the guy's name that played in Fruitvale Station. What's his name?
Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, okay, Michael B. Jordan's character. And what's the name of his character in Panther? Do you remember?
I didn't see Panther.
But anyway, his character is basically, he wants to basically go out and jack all the vanilla people for all the things that they have done to black people and take the technology from Wakanda and basically handle institutional racism and how they exploited the whole planet. So T'Challa and they wind up fighting in the movie, but they're fighting over something that's bigger than both of them. You follow me? They're fighting for something to benefit all of the people of Wakanda and all of the people of the planet that are people of color. Conversely, in the movie Superfly, you got brothers fighting over turf and drug issues and who's controlling this and who's controlling that. Michael Jackson touched on these issues when he was dealing with Crips and the Bloods. I think he even introduced Wesley Snipes when he did that thing like, I'm bad. And you saw the guys on the roller skates coming on and Wesley Snipes, and they tied a little thing around them like some people used to fight in the late 50s games where, you know, you tie your arm up with a neckerchief and you got one hand free and one hand tied, and the two of you guys fight it out. But that was a smart fight because that meant whoever won that particular gang had access to do whatever the other things were they wanted to do. But when you look at all these turf wars, all this fighting that's going on, you have all this collateral damage, kids getting killed, innocent people getting killed, and all those kinds of things, I'm suggesting to you that this movie is putting back in the minds of young black folk, you got to go out and get paid. There's nothing wrong with you selling drugs, having a few women turning tricks for you, and blowing a few people away just to go out and get paid so that you can live your life. And I use the language not to insult the millennials, but the people that are between the ages of about 26 and about 34, those individuals are operating out of the mindset of, hey, you know, I got to get mine. They don't realize that they're standing on the shoulders of their ancestors. They don't realize that they're standing on the shoulders of people that have made major sacrifices for them. They just think that they have to get theirs. So that is one of the messages in that movie. It leans more toward individualism and power for a person rather than empowering the community.
Wow. Now, I haven't, and I have no intention of seeing the new Superfly, but just from that alone, at this particular period in time, anything that's promoting black death and I'm going to have to pay money to sit down for 90 minutes or however long it is and watch a whole lot of black people be killed and gunned down by other black people. Like, oh, man, like I have seen enough. We already mentioned Boys in the Hood. We mentioned New Jack City. We mentioned Superfly the first time around. Like, I'm good. I said the same thing with The Hate U Give. All of the Negro trauma dramas, I'm good. We've had enough of those. Let's just go about the business of replacing white supremacy with justice. And I'm especially opposed to anything that is promoting black death. That's the only way that we can think about.
Let me give you some perspective. Mm-hmm. Usually, when I say usually, I would say greater than 75 to 80% of the time. Unless I am using movies to teach in class, I will wait for these things to pop up on cable files, all right, like Infinity, right? I will wait. I don't put my money in those kinds of things, right? I just want to say usually. Conversely, if it's something that we are discussing and is hot in the media, there are times on that 30% side that I will plug into and say, listen, in order for me to be able to do an assessment of how incredibly damaging these kinds of scripts are in terms of the cinematography, what they put together, it's part of my duty to be a liaison to help people of color make sense out of this kind of pathology. Like, for example, I never saw Precious, and I still haven't seen Precious, all right, the movie for that sister, the comedian that got the Academy Award for it, right? But I do know it was some serious pathology in Precious, you feel me? And I mentioned that to you to say that there are certain levels of pathology that I just choose not to engage. I'll read about them, and I'll help people get some perspective. But when I mentioned to you what I said about the character and the new Superfly, and from just looking at the imagery that you find online, when you look at this tall brother, probably pecan complexion, well-groomed, even has some African garments on in some of the scenes, right? But the way his hair is cut and cropped, that sends a message to a lot of black women and a lot of other black men that this is what people like. And I don't need to tell you, man, like what people see in the cinema, people have a tendency to duplicate. And as a matter of fact, toy stores will actually put things on the shelf. You watch this Christmas, even this Halloween, you're going to see Panther people dressing up like they're from Wakanda. It's because they exploit it. They sell it. And if you were to back up and look at Shaft was the closest thing that we had to a James Bond movie when Isaac Hayes dropped the score for Shaft when it came out. And what's that brother's name? I forgot his name, but he wanted to play James Bond. A lot of black women think he's a handsome brother. What's his name?
Idris Elba.
Idris Elba. You know, and I understand that M6, M5, people in the UK and people in the United States were tripping like they did not want to have a black man to play James Bond. You know, how dare you entertain the thought of having a black man play James Bond? Because James Bond did what? James Bond had all the women and James Bond had license to kill. So they don't want that kind of message reverberating throughout the world. Are you feeling me? So again, back to me talking about what happens in the movie of Superfly. Be mindful. Atlanta is the black Mecca. Atlanta is the hub. As a matter of fact, they made Panther in Atlanta. Are you feeling me? That's where they did 95% of the shooting was done in Atlanta. Might have been 100% of the shooting was actually done in Atlanta with blue screens and green screens. So when you put those kinds of things in perspective and think about Morehouse College and Spelman College being down there, Morehouse College had a problem probably about 5 to 7 years ago. The president had to take a statement, a position, to tell the guys that they couldn't go to class dressing like girls. Are you feeling me? So maybe we'll talk a little bit about African-Americans or black people committing suicide before we go off the air, but I just wanted to amplify how critically important it is for us to understand that we use movies to program people. And just remember this, because you are way too young to know. There was a time that the only time you saw more than 5 black people in a movie in the 60s, more than 5 black people, it was some shit about Tarzan. And anytime you saw more than 5 black people in a movie, and if it was related to Tarzan, they were getting killed. They were getting killed, and the chimpanzee was being glorified, all right? So be mindful of how Hollywood has portrayed black and brown people, and be mindful of what Hollywood did to the Native Americans who were here before vanilla people crawled out of Caucasus Mountains. They were already here. They had the audacity to come here and rename all these Native American clans of people Indians out of the ignorance of Chris Loss understanding where the hell he was. And even to this day, the Native American Museum in Washington, D.C., they still talk about Indian culture. Are you feeling me? So we have basically bought the misnomer, the lack of identifying who we are, and allowed the colonizers to identify us. And why I pointed out that brother's character, the way he's dressed, the way his hair is because black people will tell you from now until the end of this year and probably 2020 that they still want to choose someone to have children with that has light skin and good hair.
Context of white supremacy. Talked about that with Superfly. Light skin, good hair, in quotes. Good hair. I did see the first, I think, 45 minutes of Precious. I had a visceral response to the film. It was so trashy and anti-black. I thought I was going to be nauseous. I had to discontinue at about the 45-minute mark. But that informs why I have not seen Black Panther, why I have no intention of seeing the new Superfly, why my basic code has been, if it's a significant number of black people, and if it's a film being promoted as, oh yeah, this is a black film, lots of black characters in it, I don't want to see it, probably am not going to enjoy it, probably will see it as something that's promoting a lot of anti-blackness. That's pretty much been what I've seen for about the last 2 decades, 20 years or so, a few exceptions, but not too many. I have avoided it for a lot of...
May I ask you a question?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Have you seen Black Lightning?
No, sir.
Black Lightning is on Netflix. Black Lightning, you might want to see Black Lightning. One of the themes around Black Lightning is Caucasian scientists have tried to figure out a way to sedate all black people. And they've used things from water to drugs to sedate black people. And the superhero in Black Lightning actually is able to control electrical current just like lightning. You feel me? And they basically have genetically modified a lot of black people, and they've had some throwbacks that are anomalies in terms of what they were trying to get. Rather than them getting, like, you might say, a 99% level of docility, they get something like about 70% docility and maybe about 28% of people that are not docile but are just kind of having struggles with mental health problems. And two, they get a group of people that wind up that are superheroes, but they don't know they're superheroes. They're basically like anomalies. You feel me? And as a result of that, that movie, that series is something that's really worth looking at. Are you feeling me?
Hmm.
It's something that's really worth looking at.
Black Lightning. I will put a pin in. I will watch an episode once I get a free moment. I'll report back once I've seen it. Listeners can feel free to drop me a line or what have you if you've seen it, if you're familiar with it, if that is an exception to the rule of what I have generally seen. Did you actually get to see Black Panther?
Yeah, my brother, I'm telling you, if you check it out, it's a whole nother different type of message. You feel me? Hello?
I'm not. Oh, yes, sir. I was.
No.
I just have been very reluctant for a lot of reasons. Some of our guests have shared a thought or two. Even Dr. Martin Kevorkian, he's an admitted white supremacist. He was on the broadcast, and we did discuss it briefly there. And he did raise some concerns about the project. I think he had seen the film, and he did have some critiques. He has written about white supremacy in film, but perhaps down the line I'll see it. Just Marvel has got me before. I've said this before. I did see the miniseries that they did, Luke Cage, and I thought it was horrendous. It was extraordinarily anti-black. I mean, there was a scene where they had the main character dipped in acid, and I just said, I mean, really, I just cannot subject myself to another 90 minutes or whatever it is of Marvel.
You know, maybe one day I can tell you about you being an empath, because you were an empath. I don't know exactly how tall you are, but from some of the things you told me, you're an empath. An empath, you pick up a lot of people's pain. Okay, there was a movie, I forgot the name of it. There was a alien movie made. I forgot the guy's character name, but he came from out of space and he took on the hair from the guy that had passed, and he took his body and he used his genetic material to basically regrow himself through. I forgot the name of the movie, but the point that I'm making is you're an empath. And empaths, typically, they pick up energy, and the energy gives them more information than the actual script. And they can read the energy, and once they read the energy, they have to remove themselves from the energy, because it can make them present themselves from general malaise to feeling ill to just overall nauseous, like they just don't want to be around that kind of energy. They don't want to be around that kind of energy. And I know you're an empath. That's why I practice Raja Yoga, because I'm an empath too. And I know how to burn that stuff off of me so it doesn't stick to me. You feel me? And because you told me that you had a BMI that was, from what you told me, probably had to be over 22. You feel me? Unless you're 6'5 or 6'6. You feel me? You're an empath. So you basically find that kind of crap aversive. You know, it's totally, it goes against the health of what you're about. And so you spend a lot of time healing people through high energy waves, i.e. The medium that you're using right now, cyberspace. Because information is healing. Information can actually awaken people that have been colonized to the fact that they have been colonized, and it can empower them to take action for their own destiny. And you do that all the time. Then I actually admire you for doing that. But let me be quiet and allow you to take the conversation wherever you'd like to take it.
Much obliged. Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Dr. Niana Rasayan. You can visit his website, eyesofmaat.com. eyesofmaat.com if you want more information. Check out some of his books. You, again, can go back in the archives and check out some of the many times that he has visited with us down through the years. I know I definitely want to make sure that I get to the suicide component with black children, because I do think that's super important. But since we were talking about films, entertainment, I also wanted to make sure that I got your thoughts on the Me Too movement, what they're calling it, campaign addressing sexual assault. Primarily against women, even though there are a lot of males that are also victims of sexual assault. Most recently, Bill Cosby, R. Kelly, Morgan Freeman, three pretty well-known black males that have been, well, Bill Cosby convicted in a court of law second time around in his sexual assault trial. Morgan Freeman more recently has been accused of making sexually inappropriate comments. And R. Kelly, who for years, now decades really at this point, has faced a litany of allegations of criminal sexual misconduct and Spotify pulling his music from their playlists. What do you make of these prominent black males now being some of the folks in the forefront of the Me Too attack, saying, hey, we've got these toxic males who are running rampant and abusing females?
First thing I want to do is I want to remove R. Kelly from the equation of talking about Bill Cosby, Morgan Freeman. R. Kelly is a different, he's in a whole nother league by himself, okay? All right?
Why is that?
And the kinds, why is that? Because of the kinds of accusations that have been made about R. Kelly have basically been disseminated for a long period of time, and they have proven to have a different kind of cohort of people that have put their finger on R. Kelly. And as a matter of fact, I think the Boondocks even did a little weird special on R. Kelly one time, talking about what he, as they said in the Boondocks, nobody's debating the fact that R. Kelly is an incredible song stylist and the brother can sing, compose, and do dynamite things with music. But I would not put R. Kelly in the same, under the same rubric of the kinds of things that Morgan Freeman in particular has been accused of. And neither would I put him in the same conversation with Bill Cosby. I just want to be clear. I would differentiate. I would remove him from that category. But I can speak specifically. Go ahead.
I thought Bill Cosby faced accusations for a number of decades as well.
Bill Cosby has. However, I would also point out to you, I don't think Bill Cosby has anything in his history that suggested that he was exploiting. He was doing anything under the rubric that would constitute pedophilia, all right, of being involved with children, all right? I don't think Bill Cosby has that under his quote-unquote misfortunes. I also think, sad, and I'm not defending Bill Cosby, but Bill Cosby was in that era when everybody, when I say everybody, everybody knows some anybody that are connected to Playboy clubs in those days, women were always aware, and the terminology was in place, don't let a person slip you a Mickey, all right? The date rape drug, all right? Ladies, be mindful that don't let a guy give you a drink because it's going to do something to you. You're not going to know who you are in the whole nine yards. And I know Bill Cosby probably did do some of those things that people said that he did, but I think they tried to put Bill Cosby in front of us as a poster boy for the kinds of behavior that Caucasian men have been doing ever since they crawled out of the caves to women, ever since they have had fraternities and sororities on campus. They've been known to get women drunk, to violate them sexually, even have sex with them while they're unconscious, okay? And I wish I knew the name of the school. It was an elite school somewhere on the East Coast where seniors would take little freshman girls on top of the roof and violate them sexually, and they call themselves taking them upstairs for the senior salute to give them a kiss. And they would do everything from digitally raping them to actually having sex with them and occasionally pulling what we used to call a train on them, all right? So Bill Cosby, I don't think he's the poster boy for this kind of behavior, and I think that we're doing ourselves a disservice to allow him to be the poster boy, and I also think that's diversionary. The other thing in terms of Morgan Freeman, I think that the epitome of individuals that have done things to violate women is occupying 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue right now. He is the epitome of individuals that do those kinds of things to women. And as a matter of fact, if you would look at his history, I understand his father oversaw a brothel for a long period of time, but yet he's the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So I think that as we talk about Bill Cosby, in particular Morgan Freeman, I think those things are diversionary. And again, I want to reiterate, I do not put R. Kelly in the same category of African-American men that I put Bill Cosby and Morgan Freeman.
Thank you for indulging me to explain your demarcation or differentiation between R. Kelly and Bill Cosby and Morgan Freeman. Appreciate that. You said you think this is diversionary. What's your response to people? In fact, I just saw today, literally hours before we went live, there's a sitcom that's coming out. Their entire third season, this is on HBO, this is not some ragtag affair. Their entire third season is going to be devoted to the theme of toxic black masculinity. Not toxic masculinity, toxic black masculinity. What was your response?
Pause.
Okay.
Pause. And the pause is going to be consistent with the second part of your question, because you said not toxic masculinity, but toxic black masculinity. That's just like what Malcolm pointed out, that when you look in the dictionary, you look for black cat, something bad, black cake, devil fool's cake, black ball, eight ball. Dr. Wilson talks about that in ISIS papers. Black is always associated with something evil. Africa, the black, the dark continent, is always something evil. Beelzebub, Lucifer, he comes out of the dark, the red devil. He's black. He comes out of a black environment. So that's designed to program people and to distract people from what's really going on in the world, in my opinion. Now, specifically regarding toxic masculinity, I'll quote a brilliant brother that I know that does broadcasts on a regular basis. He said, white women are good at coming together as a group to make things happen. They took down Bill Cosby. I think the Renegade said that some time ago. You remember that?
how white women come together to take down people. They took down Tiger Woods and took down Bill Cosby. Is that something that you said?
That sounds like something I might have said.
Yeah, well, you go back into your archive, you'll find that you said that. So my point is, you said that in the context of the presidential election about how, quote, white women, they lie all the time. Mm-hmm. White people, they lie all the time. White women went into that voting booth, and they pulled the lever or they punched the little thing, and they voted for the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That was your theme, and that was your thesis. Mm-hmm. And I'm agreeing with that. And so what I'm saying to you is, white women are good at coming together to do things and malign African-American men, and black men in particular. They're very good at doing that. They're excellent at doing that. You could even go back and do a reboot in not 21st century. You could do a 2018 version of Driving Miss Daisy and swapping down that Morgan Freeman would get Miss Daisy half drunk and then go in the back and tag her behind a few times sexually, as we used to say, crush that. You feel me? And people would say, oh, wow, is that what he did to Miss Daisy? Is that why she really liked him driving around? But as soon as he got caught for doing it, the story would be, oh, wow, he violated this old white woman. He did X, Y, and Z to her. You feel me? There was another movie that came out, and I wish I knew the name of it, whereas this Caucasian woman said that the brother did something to her sexually, and she took the position that he had raped her, even though she gave it to him willingly. But when she got caught, she immediately cried rape, okay? Cried rape, you feel me? And I think they were about to kill the brother for it. What I'm getting at is this, toxic masculinity. They're going to do a special about toxic masculinity. They need
toxic
to do a special.
Toxic black masculinity. Toxic black masculinity.
Yeah, and I appreciate you underscoring black, but that is my point. Toxic masculinity is what they should be talking about rather than toxic black masculinity, because when they say toxic black masculinity, that skews the focus to think that it's black men that's violating all these people. That's why I reference the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I have told my students in my human sexuality class, I'll just say P and not say the kitty cat version of the word P, all right, with the U-S-S-Y that goes with the P. He said, quote, you can just go in and grab a woman by the P. And I would say in my class, I can't even say the word. And I'm talking about human sexuality, because if I said the word in my class talking about human sexuality and how we violate and marginalize and rape women verbally and then rape women digitally and then rape women by vaginal penetration, we cannot actually use the kind of language that the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue used to talk about how women are violated, because someone would raise their hand and go and report and say, you know, Dr. Rossian was cursing in his class, and this is what he said about women. And Richard Pryor had a joke that he used to tell for the longest, and I love it. It's not going to come across as funny the way I'm going to put it, because I'm going to leave out the punchlines. But the story that Richard Pryor used to say, white policemen used to run around and harass black men when they were hanging out with more than two on a corner. And if a brother was standing on the corner with one leg on the wall and one foot on the ground and one foot on the wall, palming his crotch, white men would come over and say, you need to move. Get away from here. Doing blah, 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 loitering in public and stuff like that. And they could get arrested for putting their hands on their genitals in public. And so Richard Pryor said that he explained to the white folk to ask him, and so we're like, why do black men always do that? And Richard Pryor say, damn, you done took everything else, so we're going to hold on to our jewels, which means that no matter what we do, no matter how we do it, they always identify us. Dr. Frances Quest Wilson pointed out for the longest with some of her simplistic graphic designs of a gun from a side or a lateral view, all right? She would show you a man with an erect penis and a scrotum. And she said, what white people see is they see a gun. And what can come out of the gun barrel are spermatozoa. And the spermatozoa that come out of the gun barrel is the shaft of a male's penis. And the actual magazine that's in the bottom of the gun is the scrotum. And it has genetic material. Dr. Wilson talked about that over and over again, that is what the white man is afraid of, his genetic annihilation. And so one of the easiest ways to marginalize and get rid of a people is to marginalize them and devalue them. That's the exact same thing that the Minister of Information did in Nazi Germany. That's what the Führer had done by his chief minister of propaganda. They marginalized and dehumanized the Jews, and then they justify what they did to send over 10 million people to crematories.
Dr. Welsing certainly talked about studying, the importance of studying and applying what one learns from Nazi Germany, that history. But back to toxic black masculinity. So that's the theme for this program that's supposed to be coming out. And I raised that in the context. My question was going to be some pushback to say, well, hey, if you're saying that this Bill Cosby convicted sexual abuser and Morgan Freeman and R. Kelly saying that this is diversionary, distracting us from, you know, things that are a greater priority. Like, wait a minute, you know, sexual assault, that is a huge priority. You know, some of Bill Cosby's accusers are black females. It's not even that they're all white women. Certainly, even though you said, you know, there's a difference, but certainly some of, you know, R. Kelly's accusers, many of them are black a female. So this is not even about racism, white supremacy per se. This is about abuse of females. How can you say that this is diversionary when there could be authentic crimes taking place here?
Two things. Let's not bury ourselves in it just literally being diversionary. There is a fundamental military strategy that's used for anyone that thinks they have won a war or certain theaters of battle. They triangulate. They hit you with several things at the same time. Now, while you guys have borderline Damien growing up at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue from the Oldman, actually occupying 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue right now, okay, doing all kinds of things that we know that if Obama had done, God knows how the media would have handled him in terms of proposing that he be immediately impeached and the kinds of things that he said and actually got elected. Now, back to it being diversionary. It's a difference between me saying something that's being diversionary and not being basically debilitating and devastating and deleterious to a group of people. Abuse of women, by women or by men, is definitely a crime, period. I'm not suggesting that those are not criminal behaviors. I am suggesting that the timing is quite peculiar. When you look at the timing, and you look at, I think, the lady that's now identified lesbian that alleged and got documentation and corroboration in court that he, quote-unquote, was found guilty of giving her several drugs that allowed her not to be in possession of her faculty while he violated her in whatever fashion it was that she alleged that he violated her, and they got a conviction for it from 2004, all right? And that became in your face in the news. I think that was diversionary given what was going on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Secondly, this stuff about Morgan Freeman, you follow me, none of which has been corroborated, but it's kind of dancing around in the news. That's why I say it's diversionary. And nobody is able to talk about the Caucasian women that actually helped skew the vote with Putin's nudge, plus Caucasian women voting for the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, have created an atmosphere that allows someone to actually come up with a program and actually put black in it as a precept to talk about how men marginalizes and how men basically treat women and put black in it as part of the title. I think that's diversionary. That brings our attention back to devaluing black men and marginalizing black men. It does not suggest that black men have not abused women in any way. I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying that that will become the focus for the conversation. Process that taking place in the media while we find ourselves talking a little bit about Superfly and folks are still running around the planet happy as hell that they finally got a superhero. And I saw Panther. It wasn't anything that was absolutely mind-blowing about the movie. It just so happens that black people were so thirsty to see a quote-unquote superhero that everybody flocked around the theater to go see Panther, all right? Not taking anything away from, what's his name, Chad Bosman. The brother can act, no doubt about that. But when you take the icon, the iconic father of American television, i.e. who happened to have been a gynecologist or obstetrician gynecologist on national TV, happened to have been married to an attorney, Claire Huxtable, with a silly name, Cosby Show and the Huxtables, you follow me, and then you decide to put him in front of us right now to be the person that represents the signature abuser of women, I think that's completely diversionary. And then you take the other person that's played in I don't know how many movies next to that brother that, what's that brother's name that, and not Morgan Freeman, the other brother, that's Samuel Jackson, all right? You take Morgan Freeman, who's a well-known actor, you take him and you take Bill Cosby, and now you want to put them in front of us and talk about how they have treated women and the misogyny, black misogyny, and what black men have done, and then put in that same equation R. Kelly, use some common logic. You got a person that's on the music circuit talking about music, all right, and singing. The brother can definitely sing, and some of his lyrics are absolutely mind-blowing. And then you take the icon of American television, then you take the icon of cinema, you feel me? And now you're going to put a program together with a backdrop talking about what these men have done? Hell yes, diversionary. It gets your attention off of what's really going on the planet. Like you mentioned earlier when I was talking about water, it just popped out of your mouth with one word, even though you mentioned it later in the sentence. You said Flint when we were talking about water. I was making a comment. You said Flint, which means they really need some bottled water. You mentioned Flint. And if you were to go to West African places in West Africa, you would find that the brother Akon has put probably about 40 to 60% of his net worth into trying to figure out how to make drinkable water available to people in Africa. But that's not in the news. We're going to talk about the misogyny of how black men treat black women. You wait till we talk a little bit about suicide and what happens to the children when they don't have a daddy and a mother that's overworked. So refocus me, my brother. I'll be glad for you to refocus me.
Context of white supremacy. Akon was just here in Seattle, and that was one of the things that he was talking about, his program and trying to get clean, drinkable water. We had way back 10 years, a decade of the cows. There was a suspected race soldier on the broadcast almost a decade ago, and he said that would solve about half of the continent of Africa's problems. Not more aid, not the IMF hooking them up with some great loans, not AFRICOM, just clean water. If we could just get that straight, man, they would be on a roll. Like just clean, drinkable water. Talked about that as, you know, fundamentals earlier in the broadcast.
Discovery and Scientific American had extensive articles over the past 5 years, up to the past 7 years, talked about the new theater of war would be over water, the water wars. Because you can easily wipe out hundreds of thousands of people if you control healthy drinking water. Everything from Shigella, E. coli in the water, Clostridium, all kinds of microorganisms and bacteria in the water with no drinking water. You can wipe out buku people. And as I just told you, in Black Lightning, one of the themes in that movie has to do with folk putting stuff in the water supply. And there was a silly movie that was released probably about 10 years ago called Undercover Brother. And this movie, silly as it was about using fried chicken to make black people docile.
I'm wounded. I didn't see that one either. But that.
But you have to pay attention. They program you. You feel me? Absolutely. Not you, but I'm saying. Oh, you sure, know, sure. You know the stereotypes. Black people eat chicken.
Absolutely.
And the guy that was getting ready to run for president was supposed to be a variant of Colin Powell, right? Mm-hmm. And they had taken his identity and changed his sense of identity. And rather than him pitching his platform about what he wanted to do for president, I mean, running for president, he said he decided to open up a chain of fried chicken franchises. And, of course, that was a human witty, but it was a flashback on black exploitation movies.
Mm.
Many people are sick. They're serious about what they do, bro.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just reminded, Dr. Kamban, I can get two references in for Dr. Kamau Kamban. He and Dr. Welsing certainly would encourage reading, more important than watching television, for sure. But Dr. Kamban, he said some years ago, before the Flint situation, he said, you know, there was a blaxploitation film, not as popular as Superfly, but there was this blaxploitation film called Three the Hard Way, featuring Jim Brown, where white people said, you know, and it wasn't just white people. It was white supremacists specifically said, you know, we want to get rid of the niggers. Let's poison the water. And they go about doing that at Jim Brown. And I forget the three black people, but they go to save the day. But he said, yeah, sometimes they can be really, really honest in their films. And again, Dr. Cambon recommended seeing this. This was before the Flint situation. But anyway.
The spook who sat by the door. The spook who sat by the door carried a similar connotation. The spook who sat by the door, which used to be required reading for guys at Langley Park up until about maybe 15 years ago. The Spook Who Sat by the Door, Greenlee's book.
Yes, the late Sam Greenlee passed in 2014. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They
see, you know, the people said at one time, if you want to hide something from black people, put it in a book. They also did the same thing in the movie The Avatar. The vanilla people in the movie The Avatar were getting ready. They wiped out the whole damn planet of those people's belief system because they were trying to get unobtainium. And they're trying to get vibranium in the movie Black Panther. They're trying to get vibranium. It goes off with what can the people of Wakanda offer the people of the United Nations. And the movie goes off with, oh my God, the kinds of things you can do with vibranium. And most people don't realize vibranium is a metaphor for coltan in Africa. You see, you get in a lot of trouble when you share the kind of information that I'm sharing with you. But like I told you before, with the Narcan that they have in, which is naloxone, which is an opiate receptor blocker that they put in your body so you can reverse a person OD. I'm telling you, these vanilla people, they do not know who they are dealing with. The universe does not play. The universe is older than these people that migrated from the Caucasus Mountains who happen to be hybrids and who happen to have been genetically tampered with by some quote-unquote little bit of alien DNA. I know that sounds like the Twilight Zone to a lot of people. You feel me? These people have been genetically tampered with, and a great number of them have calcified pineal glands. So they actually have a disconnect from the spiritual core of nature. So rather than them understanding nature, they try to control nature. Nobody talks about Dolly anymore, the little sheep that they clone. They don't talk about that. Every now and then a movie pops up and tells you about the Manchurian candidate. Most people on this planet, educated black people in particular, they do not read. What they do is they prepare for their jobs based upon what their discipline has trained them to review. They don't read. And a lot of millennials, if they're not reading something directly related to their jobs or computer software or their job assignments, they are text messaging more than they're actually emailing. You feel me? And they're not reading. And I predict that 25 years from now, if people don't start reading, what is it, Fahrenheit 450 will probably be a damn reality. They will ban books until you can only get information from select sites on the internet. And you will get punished and penalized if you have certain types of information. And my book, Reality Check, probably somewhere between page 23 and 32, I have a reference in there to a brother that had his eyes burned out for reading when he was about 8 years of age. They burned his eyes out. They left scars over his eyes because he was trying to learn his alphabet by studying the Bible. And so the overseer burned his eyes out and, quote, "Let that be a lesson to all of you darkies. You ain't got no right to learn to read." And to this day, you find more black people. We don't even read. We send each other bitmojis. We send each other emoticons. We're texting each other on the damn telephone. We created our own new abbreviated language to talk to each other. And greater than 80% of all children in schools today between the ages of 14 and 15 years of age cannot tell time on an analog clock. That's the one that has the hands. If it doesn't have numbers on it, they don't know what the hell those hands are pointing at. And if you don't know anything about neurophysiology and the brain and the parietal lobes and vision, your brain processes information simultaneously, the left and the right side, as long as your vision is okay with your optic nerves. It weighs information on both sides to kind of make sense out of it. It doesn't go to the left side of your brain. But if you digitize everything, the information becomes skewed to the left side of your brain. And when it becomes skewed to the left side of your brain, you cause the right side of your brain to go through some degree of underdeveloping. The same thing happens when you don't listen to music. You listen to a lot of nonsense rap. You get that repetitive rhyme going to the left side of your brain. Repetitive rhyme, nonsense, ain't no message in it. And when you repeat stuff over and over again, it's just like creating a path and a nice front yard full of grass. there'll be a path there. So if it rains, the water will go to that path. And even though it's raining in that path, but you walk on that path, the grass will not grow there. You can program your brain the same damn way. You can program people to be violent. You can program people to be docile. And then you add food to it, you guarantee docility. You don't need to play a zombie video game. You don't even need kids to sit down and think about zombies. I can program you into being a zombie.
Context of white supremacy. We are reading Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, speaking of zombies. One thing you just said, it reminded me of a comment I had or a conversation I had with Dr. Welsing some years ago. This was not on the air, and she said she was talking about rhyming, and she said that that is a symptom of mental illness. And I'd never heard that before, so I said, oh, wow, is that like, you know, I didn't know if this was like a part of her personal crest theory or if this was like just widespread. And she said, oh, no, this is, you know, it's in medical journals. Like, you could go read, like, this is pretty widespread. But, I mean, just, you know, walking around talking in rhymes, I mean, that's generally considered.
Yeah, that is. It's a form of perseveration. It's also a sign associated with a low form of brain compromise or brain damage. People have a tendency to perseverate. There is a term in psychology, particularly related to pronounced mental health conditions that are associated with classic schizophrenia or psychotic behavior, called echolalia. And echolalia means, like, as I'm talking to you right now, in echolalia, if I'm psychotic, and with echolalia, you could say, so, hey, Dr. Rossian, what do you think about this? And this is what you said to me. And I would say, hey, Dr. Rossian, what do you think about this? And you said, come on, man, quit playing. And I would say, come on, man, quit playing. And you said, may I ask you a question? I would say, may I ask you a question? You can say, are you serious? I'll say, are you serious? See, echolalia, whatever you say, I repeat that. And you see a lot of youngsters, they repeat these nonsense rhymes. You ask them, what does the rhyme mean? Hey, I don't know, man, it just rhymes. Nikki Giovanni was a classic poetess. She said very candidly, remember I repeated it before, most people try to speak English instead of speaking through it. Some rap artists, when they rap, they're just looking for a word to rhyme with the crap. It doesn't have to make any sense. It's nonsense. There was a time when black folk communicated with simile and metaphor. You knew what they were saying. They were comparing things with analogies, things that really related to life. Now about 70% of the rap that's out here doesn't make a damn bit of sense. 30% does, but they don't usually get the airplay. So it is a form of mental illness, particularly the echolalic part of it and the part that we call perseveration, all right? Now, some rhymes are healthy, and if you know anything about rhyming and if you know anything about certain types of aphasia, a person may be able to rhyme a rhyme because it's a rhythm of speech, but they might talk to you and stutter. You feel me?
Wow. Wow. Context of white supremacy. Again, Dr. Niana Rossian. Hand up if you have a question. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you have a question. We were talking about black mental health, black overall health, within the context of white supremacy before, and particularly talking about suicide rates. We talked about suicide rates with whites before, but there was a report, someone posted it on my Facebook page earlier from U.S. News and World Report about an increase in the number of suicides with black children. Sparked my attention for a number of reasons. I think at least for a while I've heard some black people say, well, black people do not commit suicide, and, you know, that's just not something that we do. And mental illness, black mental health is a serious problem. Kalief Browder, serious problem. The system of white supremacy does a lot of damage to us in so many levels. I'm not going to read the whole report, but just to read a quick paragraph. It reads, more elementary aged African-American children have been taking their own lives, and black boys and girls between the ages of 5 and 12 are doing so at roughly twice the rate of white kids the same age. Suicide rates in the United States have traditionally been higher among white than black individuals across all age groups, a study published this month in the Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics states. However, analyses revealed that the suicide rate among those younger than 13 years is approximately 2 times higher for black children compared with white children, a finding observed in boys and girls. This was, again, in U.S. News and World Report, was published just a few days ago. Why are black children killing themselves? Do you think that this research is valid? And do you have any theories as to what could be producing this?
Well, brother, suicide, unfortunately, is a phenomena that impacts people throughout the world. But the way it's impacting children is basically, unfortunately, it's increasing. I do think the data is a little skewed, or they're talking about the range when they go from age 5 up to, like really young kids, all right? That's extremely rare. It's highly out of the ordinary, and I think they're pointing that out just to share with you that suicide is on the rise. But I would suggest to you, without any definitive data set to expand on it, several things that are going on. For example, a lot of children are watching their parents grow up stressing, right? And as they watch their parents grow up stressing, a lot of parents don't realize that the message, and I'm not blaming the parents, let's be real clear, I'm not blaming the parents. I'm getting ready to share with you that there is a cluster of factors that impacts a youngster this way. If you're a kid and you're growing up and you have that rare occasion to hear a parent talking about, I can't afford to keep this kid, you know, I can't afford this, I can't afford that, you know, their father's locked up, you follow me, and the mother is struggling with her work environment, trying to navigate racism. She doesn't have enough resources to feed the kid what she needs to eat, feed the kid. And remind me to tell you about brain allergies when I tell you about another factor, all right? So the mother oftentimes has begun to lose her faith. So she's not as anchored in her spiritual beliefs as she was, right? So she may be drinking. She could be using drugs and working her butt off. Children see that. Add to that, their kids are no longer supporting each other the way they used to support each other. When I say they used to support each other, now kids find their support oftentimes in social networks. And kids are very, very cruel in social networks. As a matter of fact, the term we use now did not exist 20 years ago, called cyberbullying. You know, people make you feel less than human online. So you feel less than human online, and if you are a gifted black kid, you know, you're excelling in school, you're doing this and you're doing that, but your mother doesn't have the kind of resource to clothe you the way she wants to, and you're not attending the school that requires you to wear uniforms. So you're being bullied there. So you feel alienated and you feel isolated. And children can, unfortunately, be very, very insensitive. Some people say cold and cruel. I prefer to say they can be very, very insensitive. So now you're completely alienated. What happens to a child when he or she feels completely alienated? They don't feel that they have anywhere to go. And trust me, a lot of kids, unfortunately, black kids, they still hear, either from their parents or from those isolated times when they're in church, you know, things are better in heaven. You follow me? God takes care of you. God is going to do that. You feel me? So if you're a young person and you don't really have a good handle on abstract thinking and your mother is struggling trying to take care of you, you might perceive yourself as a burden. And if you don't have any friends that you can lean on to support you, and the kids are so desensitized from playing video games and not talking to each other because they use social networks to communicate, where do you go? Where does that kid go that doesn't have anybody to talk to? Where does that kid go that overheard a few conversations about the mother talking to somebody on the phone or on the front lawn or in the hallway, like, this boy ain't worth shit. He comes home and just eats the food. He doesn't do anything. He's doing okay in school, but he ain't bringing no money in his house. He always complaining about people bullying him. He needs to grow up. How would you feel if you were a little child and people were marginalizing you that way and nobody has faith around you? Now, then you add to that, typically people that are oftentimes compromised cognitively, they have some pretty jacked up diets sometimes. You know, people that are depressed, they might eat things with a lot of sugar and a lot of salt in them, right? There is a whole class of cerebral allergies
that they call now the brain-gut relationship between mental illness and what happens with psychiatric conditions that directly related to eroding the immune system. And if the immune system gets eroded, you can have varying degrees of brain inflammation. And there is a very unique magazine called What Doctors Don't Tell You, and it tells you about the relationships between mood swings and general brain inflammation, right? Now, if you're a little kid, we now know that kids that present on a spectrum of autism, they could have a major food allergy related to gluten, if you will, all right? And so if your brain is slightly inflamed, imagine you having a brain, you have an itch in your brain, but you can't scratch it. Imagine you being a child, you having some thoughts that you just can't quite figure out what to do with those thoughts. You could have played a video game, right? And in that video game, you know, things could get killed and they get a new life. You can hear ministers saying that, you know, things will be all right, you know, in heaven. So, I mean, and you cannot conceptualize how to make sense out of all that abstract reasoning. And then you're dealing with a racist society, totally racist, that's marginalized your mother, and you don't know who the hell your daddy is. So who the hell are you going to turn to? I'd want to leave, too, if I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. Nobody likes you. You're a grown man. I guarantee there have been times in life when you've been depressed. And there's a stigma associated with mental illness. And a lot of parents that have little young boys in particular, and sometimes girls, if a little boy is struggling with something and the mother's working her butt off, mothers typically will say, grow up. Welcome to the real world. And you're about 8 years of age, or you're 6 years of age, or you're 5 years of age, you're 6 years of age, you need to do something other than play those video games. That might be your only sanctuary. People at school make fun of you because you're a nerd. You're really smart, very smart. And your mother's taking you to church, and then she's giving you some coins to put in the pan that goes by. Then she gets in the car and complains about how much money she put in church. And then she's offering you a religion that you see is not serving her. And like, if God was so nice, why is it that she can't afford to at least get me some decent sneakers so I won't get teased every day I go to school in these sneakers? That shit is depressing. And one of the highly correlated factors with depression is suicidal ideation, which means thinking about suicide. So yeah, that probably is a trend, because you find more black kids growing up today. And I think that sister that wrote the book, what's her name? Michelle, she wrote the book about the new Jim Crow. I forgot her last name.
Michelle Alexander.
Michelle Alexander pointed out that we have more fragmented black families today, racial-wise, than we did during slavery. Because the brothers are incarcerated, and the women are working two or three jobs to take care of the children. And the ministers are not giving them a message to live life. The ministers giving them some hope about going to heaven. And the Temptations did a song probably about 40 years ago called You Make Your Own Heaven and Hell Right Here on Earth. So our children are not trying to buy into this religiosity. So they're not trying to buy into religiosity. And neither are they comfortable enough to say to the mother, look, I think I'm really just out of it, Mama. I just don't want to be here. And the mothers would say, well, what do you want to be? I don't know. I just don't want to be here. And so you don't want to live, you want to go live with your daddy. Your daddy's locked up. She didn't even process what the kid said. I don't want to be here. What do you want to be? You feel me? Because people don't know how to do a simple screening to find out whether or not their kids are having suicide ideas. I'm real slick with mine. This is how I find out whether or not people think about suicide. If I'm talking to young kids, I might ask them, hey, do y'all celebrate Christmas in your house? Does your family get together for Thanksgiving? Do you guys do anything for Kwanzaa? Do you guys ever have family get-togethers and have cookouts or vacations? And once you get that data set, then you ask them, you think you're going to have one next year? Or what would you like to do next year? Or what do you think you're going to do when you get out of school? There was a kid in D.C. that had written a will. People were trying to figure out why this 11-year-old boy had written a will. He wrote a will because he didn't think he was going to live to finish high school. Will is video games, is PlayStation, all kinds of crap. We don't talk to the children. We park our children in front of video consoles or give them small digital devices to entertain themselves. They could excel in school, but we don't talk to them because we're too busy trying to navigate racism. And if we are an adult and our relationships are jacked up, we're too busy trying to find a decent relationship. And that really weird movie that came out, I think, in the early 90s, about 92 to 94, called Bebe's Kids, you feel me? And that movie was about a guy that really wanted to talk to a lady, but she was taking care of somebody else's kids to hang out, and they were going to go to Fun World. And the whole thesis around that movie revolved around, like, who the hell going to take care of these rowdy-ass kids? And people just want a relationship. And you can even meet people that have children, particularly if they have two or three. You can find the guy and the mother complaining. Wow, you know, these kids are up. Damn, we can't even get our swerve on. Wow, these kids are up. They eat more than I do. Damn, they need a job. Kid could be in school. That is a job. You feel me? And then you have parents wanting their kids to excel in sports. You have some parents wanting their kids to rap to go get their money. All that shit. And you a kid. And you don't have any peers, anybody to talk to, because your peers are in a social network. And they can turn on you just like the weather changes. So, yeah, they're more vulnerable to commit suicide. Add a jacked up diet to it, lack of a stable family, and then a sense of de-individuation. You don't know who you are anymore, because who you are becomes whether or not you have designer sneakers, or whether or not you have this video game, or that PlayStation 5, or that Xbox, whatever they are now. You don't have these kinds of toys. You don't have those kind of clothes and nobody to talk to. And black people still look at mental health like a stigma. The mother didn't do something right. You follow me? Or you don't have God in your life. And mental health is like they can't see it. They don't really know what it is, because you're not walking around with a limp. Your finger's not broken. Your arm is not in a sling. You don't have a Band-Aid over your eye. So if it's inside of your head, they tell you what? You need to get God in your life. You ain't got God in your life. You get God. They don't say God. They say Jesus. And I said, if I wanted to meet Jesus, I can go down and hang out over here in Atlanta where a lot of my Latino friends chill. Jesus lives right over here. No, you need Jesus in your life. And there are a lot of black people think that Jesus has abandoned them. Are you feeling me? So, yeah, it's on the uprise. It's sad, but that's reality. But it's damn sure a sad reality when you're thinking about someone younger than 10 years of age that has not even reached puberty thinking about suicide. So three factors that I think are critical: lack of family stability, they don't have anybody to interact with, and the food. And all that shit is directly related to racism and not growing up in a nurturing household. People don't laugh anymore with you, they laugh at you. And when people laugh at you, it's a really embarrassing damn situation to be in.
I see Princess dialed in. See if we can nab some of our callers in the flow. Princess, if you had commentary or a question for Dr. Rasayan, you should be with us. Princess?
I'll let someone else speak. You can come back to me later.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for calling in. Retired firefighter, if you had a question for Dr. Rasayan, you should be with us.
Greetings. I was just listening to the doctor to mention about the heightened level of young people, young black people who are subject to commit suicide. And I can definitely identify with that in my years as a firefighter, going on calls, as well as today with me being involved with this mentoring program. And, you know, the technology actually, the way it's misused, actually assists that process. I think the doctor mentioned that. Something that can be considered to be bullied, now you got 100 people who actually are chiming in on you on the computer. So I can see that happening. But the question I want to ask the doctor is going back to the talk when he was talking about when you and Gus was talking about movies. I recognize in the original Superfly movie, and there's some other movies that they would always have a part in that movie for some person or some group that I consider to be more a focus on the system of racism, white supremacy in the movie. In other words, in the original Superfly movie, they had some group that came into the restaurant where Superfly and his partner was at. That would remind the viewer at the Black Panther Party. And basically in the movie, they were ridiculed. They were ridiculed and literally forced out, but they actually left out of the restaurant by the guy who played Superfly and somebody else. And I still see that today in movies. There was a movie, I think it was called The Butler, where that that image came up in the movie, and it was ridiculed. Matter of fact, the part that was played by Oprah Winfrey, that was the part where she slapped her son in the face. because in a movie you can do just about anything. You can fix it to where you can tweak reality or some effort into a way that you want to fashion it, but it make it be obvious to the viewer on what you're talking about. And I just wanted the doctor's take on that insight that I had. Does he recognize that in movies also?
Oh, brother, you're on point, and particularly being a fireman, I'm glad you amplified that point that I just shared with Gus and the listeners. But the thing that you just made reference to Superfly, yeah, Superfly people basically old school, we call that Superfly's crew, they punked those guys. You feel me?
Right.
They just basically punked them. Like, yeah, don't come in with that black shit. We're trying to get paid, you know, blah, 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 blah. Handle your business in the whole 9 yards, right? And they were, I think they had big afros or something like that. And they looked like the so-called stereotypical element of somebody that would be remotely affiliated with the Panther Party or something like that. So they did that deliberately because they wanted to downplay that message. Because, you know, in those days, you had open carry out in California. You feel me? And brothers were, like, standing up to do the whole 9 yards. You feel me? So I recognize that. You're absolutely correct. So they gave them a little cameo peekaboo into the movie to acknowledge that was part of the era. But at the same time, they pointed out to them that you ain't got no power. The powers are here selling this, distributing this narcotic, or dropping this product and getting these gangster walls on your car and hanging out with the fine women in the whole 9 yards because Superfly was the man. And Curtis Mayfield absolutely did a wonderful job at telling the story about what Superfly was all about with his music score. And that music score is one of the things that kept the movie alive for so long. Now, in terms of the butler with Oprah, I remember when she smacked her son because he had become pro-black, if you will, had on a little dashiki or something. And the son was basically pointing out that their daddy was a Tom. You know, he's in the White House doing blah, blah, blah. And she smacked him and she shut him down. You feel me? And in reality, you may not remember in Baltimore, they also showed you this black woman beating the hell out of her son that had gone to protest about the loss of life, what happened to a black kid in Baltimore, how he had become paralyzed, whatever. And the mother whipped her behind right on TV, and they spin that and showed us that so many times in the news. They even let you see the mother basically reprimanding. There was a black woman beating the hell out of her son in public all across his head, which is like a woman is putting a young black kid in his place. So that's by design, brother. That's called media spin. You're absolutely right. They do it all the time. That's why I was telling Gus, I'm going to have to go and see Superfly so I can make more sense out of it. You feel me? Because if we don't have our people that have been trained in the social sciences to interpret this pathology, we will find ourselves becoming more and more colonized every day. So I agree with everything that you said 100%, and that's the spin that they put on. And later on, I'm going to talk a little bit about food and nutrition and brain inflammation, about how these things impact these children and make them vulnerable to suicide, because there's nothing like stress. I can tell you as a fireman, you've been in places, I don't know how many people you had the misfortune of seeing that have been burned, or the people that you had to rescue that probably didn't make it, but like when you see somebody that's been burned, yeah, and when you see that, it stays in your head, and you being a fireman, I ain't got to tell you about the smell of the stuff in the house and the smell of human skin and all that crap. That stuff stays with you. And so when you were a kid and you get stressed, your body, the cytokines that get inside of your body that screw up with your immune system and the cortisol that gets in your immune system, when you're a little young kid, your brain is very vulnerable to these little waves. It's just like somebody taking a water gun, filling it up with cayenne pepper, squirting it across certain parts of your body that are sensitive. And I'm talking about brain inflammation. So when you're a kid and you can't talk to anybody, and like you said, you got a whole group of people dogging the hell out of you in cyberspace, now you don't feel like going to school. Now you don't feel like doing well when you go to school. And your mother's like, you were getting all A's. What happened? Well, you know, we got a different teacher. Rather than saying kids are dogging me because the professor can't have a curve if I'm always getting A's. And so I'm acting white. And so there's that racism. You know, if you're bright and you're intelligent, you're acting white. If you speak well, you're acting white. You feel what I'm saying? So, brother, I'm so glad that you said what you said, and I know you're somebody that can bear witness to what you've seen, because you've probably been in any number of homes, and you've seen, unfortunately, some fires that might have been directly related to negligence. They've been related to people that just fell asleep because they're depressed, and the after effect of what it does to people, I wouldn't even begin to try to touch, because you know you've been living that life.
Yeah, a lot of it other than fires is emergency medical process and procedures. You name it as far as trauma, gunshot, stabbings, stranglings, rapes, whatever, you know, all of those type of things the fire department goes on as far as they're concerned, you know, and yeah, you see a lot. And, you know, a lot of times with that mentoring program, the mother just in desperate just turns her child, her male child over to us. Because in a lot of cases, the parents don't know how to, and I think you were talking about it, they really can't interpret what the child is stating to them. You know, they sometimes take the explanation literally, as opposed to looking beyond the words and really understanding on what that child is trying to tell him or her.
You ain't lying. I tell people all the time, and I think it's a guy that just recently came out with a couple of books, and more recently, probably over the past 7 years, hospitals give you something like a little pamphlet about what to do with your newborn baby. But I always tell people, when humans are born, you don't get a manual. You get a high-end car, a computer, you get a manual. You feel me? You can even buy a decent iron, you get a manual. You feel me? You get a manual with it. But when a kid comes on the planet, you don't get shit but that child. You feel what I'm saying? And if you are a young person having a kid, and you don't have resources, you don't know what to do, because that first child is an experiment.
Yes, sir. It's always a benefit when you come on, sir.
I'm absolutely honored that you have that perception of what I do when I share my two cents worth. I'm honored.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Let's see. Princess, did you want to share, or did you need any more time to gather yourself?
Yeah, you can go to the next caller.
Yes, ma'am. Dr. Rossam, when you were given your extremely important response about the reported increase in suicides among Black children, you were talking a lot about Black boys and their response in terms of what's happening with Black girls, because the article said Black boys and Black girls. Do you think their experience is the same, or do you think there might be some differences in terms of what they're experiencing?
Well, you know, one of the things that's a really, really difficult subject for a lot of African Americans to talk about, and I'm going to try and breach it with some diplomacy, but it's a reality. Probably about 4 months ago, I had a young kid. He was probably somewhere around, well, I just stretch his story out just a little bit, not take it out of context, but the age, because I see a lot of people, and I don't want anybody to think that I'm talking about that particular kid. Let's say I had this youngster that was actually 9 years of age, and they had bring your parent to school day, and this kid was struggling with the fact that his parents, both of his parents, were women. You feel me? And from his point of view, and the kids teased the crap out of him, like, damn, you got two mamas. You know, and at that age, you know, 9-year-olds, they still ask people, do they sleep in the same bed? And he really wasn't able to dissect that story for them to give them some context for it. Because some guys, they came to school, you know, they had their daddies, you know, and I wouldn't say their daddy was a firefighter, but he could have been a policeman. He did something that was so-called masculine, you know, and so the kids just teased the hell out of him. He was by himself. He was actually depressed over that for the longest, right? And when he finally told me, he couldn't talk to his mother about it because his mother was the, for lack of a better term, was the least assertive one in their relationship. And her mate was the more assertive one in the relationship. So her mate was the one that you might say had more of the presentation of the father figure of being more paternal. And his mother was more maternal. So he was a little convoluted about how to tell his moms that he was embarrassed about the fact that he had two mothers because he didn't really want them to come to school that day on parent day. You follow me? Because as I talked to them and got to know them better, she's basically telling me that he needed to get in touch with the real world. That's the way it is, you know, and black man this way and that way, and she found someone that showed her respect and a whole nine yards, and I had to disallow myself from being her therapist when she actually said to me in a session, this is what she said. She said, well, look, you know, I've grown tired of the way men treat me, and she named her companion. Her companion shows her respect and treats her well in the whole nine yards. And I could relate to that in the context of that's what you need. But you might want to consider exposing your son to a male figure that is actually a nurturing male figure. And she basically said to me quite candidly, like, most of these men out here ain't shit. Period. You know? And she kind of told me I was an exception to the rule. And I'm like, I'm an old dude, you know what I'm saying? And I understand what's going on, but you talking to me like this in a session, I can only imagine what kind of language you might have used around your offspring. You feel what I'm saying? So I had to disallow myself and recommend that they see somebody else. You feel me? Because pretty soon I would have been infringing on her relationship in a manner to let her know that your relationship with your companion or your mate is actually viewed from your son as somewhat toxic because you do not give him a forum to make sense out of it. You just basically tell him to deal with it. Because the last question that I asked her was, well, does he know anything about his daddy? He doesn't need to know anything about his daddy. Only thing he needs to know about his daddy doesn't pay these bills. I'm like, you got this anger with his daddy, and you maligning his daddy, and you're finding sanctuary in your new relationship. But as you malign his daddy, you're also maligning men, which means you are maligning his male energy. You feel me? And that's a real sensitive issue for a lot of black folk, because a lot of black folk are in these relationships that are basically like, I'm a guy, you a guy, you a girl, I'm a girl, and you find more sanctuary and comfort in those kind of relationships. And kids can't make sense out of that crap. And I'm just using that for an example. So you add that to the equation, and then people talking about how much little boys eat when they're growing up, because parents do that. They'll say, like, you're like a shark. You're like an eating machine. I just gave you so-and-so and so. And so they don't feed them the children food that's nurturing. They feed them food to fill up their stomach, but they don't have the right protein in it. And sometimes they give them food with a lot of gluten in it from jacked-up version of wheat, which is not natural wheat. And kids actually wind up with varying degrees of brain inflammation. And nobody talks about brain inflammation because most people ain't got no knowledge of neuroscience. And as a matter of fact, most people don't realize that a severe case of the flu or a severe long-standing ear infection or a long-standing upper molar tooth infection can actually create some brain compromises in you later on in life, because we don't know that. And trust me, mainstream physicians not going to tell you, because greater than 70% of them, they don't know either. Are you feeling me?
Wow. I want to make sure I try and nab all of our callers. The person who dialed in 5771. Did you have a question for Dr. Rasayan?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Dr. Rasayan. Greetings to Gus and all the callers and listeners. I got a question. Can you comment on the stress some of these children have in regards to when their parents tell them that they have to leave the house when they become 18, which is the legal age where parents are able to, remove their children from the house? Because I feel this is a mistake of putting children out there in the world where they're not prepared, you know, especially in a world of racism, white supremacy, where they're not even prepared to, you know, to deal with all this. And I think some of the non-white black children are told at a young age that once they become 18, that they're going to have to leave the house. And I think this contributes to a lot of the stress that, you know, the children have in regards to, you know, what am I going to do when I become 18. So can you comment on that, Dr. Rustam?
Yeah, unfortunately, brother, that is definitely a reality, because when we become adults, we forget how crazy we were before we were when we turned 18. And there are incalculable distractions that children deal with today from as soon as they're able to talk
and go through puberty. You know, I mean, because they have access to the internet, they find out all kinds of things. Then they have parents reminding them of, like, and some parents will actually say that, boy, you need to get yourself a part-time job. You need to do blah, 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 because you eat more than you're worth in this house. And then some parents will actually say it. I'd be so glad when this boy turned 18 years of age, you know, he's hanging out down the corner playing basketball, won't pull his pants up, rather than saying, sweetie, you know, this is the world we live in, because a lot of times the parents feel overwhelmed. They don't know how to talk to the children, and they don't know how to talk to the children, and they don't have enough financial resources, and nobody taught them how to prepare food, so they do some of the same things that their parents did, and then you got that diabetes kicking in, and kids have, I'm going to call them brain allergies, because certain types of food can create varying degrees of brain inflammation that we don't put a term on, because nobody's looking at general brain inflammation in a young black kid's head. So parents often say stuff like this: well, you know, by the time you turn 18, at least you can join the military. It used to be something called a Peace Corps for black kids growing up. You know, they wanted to get old so they could get out of the house. And most parents don't realize that a lot of young boys, they want to grow up. They want to grow up and get out of the house. Some of them think that by the time they turn 12 that they are a man. And when they can actually wake up with a real firm erection, they start looking for a positive outlet. And sometimes those young boys are pursued by girls that are a little bit older than them. And God forbid, sometimes these little young boys are preyed upon by pedophiles, older men, some of whom, oftentimes many of whom, are in the church. So before they get 18, they have this thing in front of them. It's not like a carrot hanging in front of them. It's like a time bomb. It's like, damn, I'm getting older while I'm getting taller, while I'm eating more. I've outgrown my clothes. Mama can't afford to do this. So that's pressure. And when you add that pressure to it, and then the parents would say from time to time, and kids don't miss shit. They see everything. They don't miss it. They're in the background. The mother's on the phone talking to her girlfriend, or she's in there texting, or they leave their phone unlocked because there's nobody in the house that's worried about looking at it. The kid sees the text message. The kids hear the mother talking about them. Like, this boy's going to have to get a job. He's going to have to get out of here. He's going to be 18 after a while. That's pressure like you wouldn't believe. This is what I would say to you to amplify how critically important what you just brought up is. Imagine you being an adult and you're married to someone and you're in between jobs, and every now and then, probably once a week, you hear your mate say, look, I'm getting tired of supporting his grown behind. He's going to have to get a job. But suppose he's been locked up. It's hard for him to get a job, you know, because you got to check that box in a lot of states, right? So nobody wants to hire him. He wants to work, right? So he finds himself out doing something illegal just to bring some money in the house. You feel me? And then you got that woman that's saying that she's bringing in all the money. You need to come to church with me. And the kid sees this guy, and the kid is like, well, I don't want to be treated that way. I'll be glad when I get 18. And the kids say that sometimes when they're angry. They'll say, I'll be so glad when I'm 18 when I can leave. You know what mothers say? You're 16. You can leave when you get ready. Because adults will have arguments with children like they're talking to another adult. And that child doesn't have any sense of being in power. Now, in white households, what oftentimes happens is a homicide. The kid will kill the damn parents or screw them up. In the black household, the kid might leave or go out and do drugs to get in trouble. I've even had young black men to say to me that when they get locked up, at least they got somewhere to sleep and they're getting three meals a day. So they worry about that. And it's a lot of pressure on them. And I would say to listeners that don't know, the frontal lobes of your brain that allow you to make sense out of reality and navigate your life and plan well, your frontal lobes in your brain are not even beginning to fully develop until you get over the age of 25. You feel me? They begin to do distinct peekaboos at around 21. Peekaboo meaning you begin to have some insight, some general perspective about life. Up until about 20, mid-20s to about 29, that part of your brain actually develops that allows you to make sense out of reality, negotiate things, and have sound judgment. Prior to then, a lot of times you just do crap. You can ask the average child, the average teenager, why did you do that? And they'll say crap like this: I don't know. Why you keep doing the same thing over and over again? You're not using drugs. You're not drinking. I don't know. And then you ask the average parent that's in his or her 40s or 50s, you'll say things to them, particularly if they don't have a viable relationship with someone they love. They'll say stuff like this: it's in God's hands. I'm taking one day at a time. So that's a lot of pressure on a person, particularly the male child. It's a lot of pressure.
Appreciate that, caller.
5771. Double checking or final check. Speak now or forever hold your peace. Princess, did you have a question for Dr. Rossion?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Or a comment.
Well, never mind. That's okay.
That's why I said or a comment, Gus, because sometimes people don't have a question, they have a comment. Oh. We're not going to beat you up, Princess.
Oh, yeah. I'm very familiar with people and their tendency to have comments and not questions on this here platform for pretty much the bulk of our 10-year period. I have frowned upon callers just making comments because it's been my experience that they will have like 15 minutes of comments and no question. I try to encourage people to see if they can put their comment in the form of a question, just in the interest of being brief and not having long, unending soliloquies from callers about sometimes things that have zero relevance to what we've been discussing at all. But I didn't think Princess was
going to do that. I encourage it because you kicking Alex Trebek in here like Jeopardy. You know, it's okay, I'm cracking a joke. You know, like, ask your question. No, I encourage people to make comments because I think I can learn from everybody, you know. And obviously, we're not able to cover some of the – I'm known to have PowerPoint presentations when I cover complex material. Like I keep talking about brain inflammation because the average black person doesn't realize that greater than 70% of all classic mental health conditions are directly related to brain inflammation, which is related to stress, which is related to poor diets, and related to some general endocrinological imbalances. So I spend a lot of time talking about that because racism is one of the most long-standing, ongoing stresses for people of color to try and deal with every day because it has so many faces, you know?
For sure.
Princess, I wish you had been a little bit more comfortable to drop your comment or your question, my sister.
Gus can be very intimidating, and he threw me off.
Well, Gus will let you slide when I'm. Gus will let you slide when I'm here. You feel me? Because Gus knows, like, we cool.
No, he's not. Mm-mm.
Well, Gus has been practicing yoga, so you should give Gus the benefit of the doubt. And see, I know what yoga does to you. Gus knows too. He's more recently found out. I don't know if those vanilla people got your certification in order for you yet, but yoga will change you because yoga is clearly Kemetan or Alkabulanese, or some people say African. It comes straight out of home. All right.
Well, I did want to. I did have a question, but I just don't know how to say it because it's been a while since I've called in because I've been dealing with some stuff, workplace stuff. But you were talking about, I didn't hear the first part of what you was talking about as far as Bill Cosby and stuff like that. But I just feel that those recent cases with those black males, unfortunate as it is, I think some of them have kind of dug their own graves. And I just don't understand why people are spending too much time in trying to make excuses for whatever their behavior is. I mean, I'm not justifying, you know, like Bill Cosby being wrongfully accused. I just feel, you know, that he kind of set himself up in that situation because of how he ostracized himself from the black community. And it's kind of like the same thing with Morgan Freeman and R. Kelly. I agree. He's in another category of his own, but it's still the same thing. And also I did want to, well, it's my belief that I feel that most black males now are to a point where they create more problems than any when it comes to a lot of relationship dramas because I guess they have their own hurt. And instead of going through a process of healing and admitting, they try and take it out on black females a lot.
Those are excellent points you're making. Excellent points you're making. Keep going. You're on the same page that Gus was on, so keep going.
Please. No, because he might say that I'm being a feminist.
Okay, no, my dear, I'm not going to call you a
hang
feminist.
On a second. Hang on a second.
Yeah.
When have you, hang on a second, because I mean, words are important. I talk about that all the time on the program about being serious, and particularly if you, I don't think anything is funny at all, because I have a question. Now, when have you heard me call someone a feminist on this program?
Never. I'm just
okay.
Joking.
That's not something to joke about. That's not something to joke about at all, because people do get very upset about that. And I have been accused of calling people a feminist before. If we're talking about racism, white supremacy, let's be serious. Let's not make accusations. You have a comment or question?
All right, Gus, put your car. See, I can talk to Gus like this because we're cool. All right, Gus, put your vehicle in neutral.
And actually, right? I was talking. Yeah.
No,
I was not interrupting.
No, you put it in neutral, brother. I'm older than you, okay? Put your vehicle in neutral.
Boop. We have a mute button as well. That is one thing I am serious about in terms of accusations on the program. Let's not make accusations. If we're going to be serious, let's be serious in dialogue. All right.
Oh, did you? Gus muted me. Did you know that? Princess, I'm going to jack him when I talk to him off the air. You muted me, didn't you, boy? I'm going to jack you. Listen, no, Princess, I think your points are valid. And I do think Gus is trying to put some stuff in context and clarify stuff, because that's a powerful word when he points out feminists. And I'm glad we kind of prime you a little bit to say what you had to say, because I want to clarify. I'm not suggesting to you that Heathcliff Huxtable, Bill Cosby, did not do any of those things that he was, quote unquote, convicted of. What I said when I mentioned to Gus was, I think this is diversionary. And I'm not even glad or reinforcing you actually agreeing with the part about me putting R. Kelly in a different category. And I do know about Morgan Freeman and so forth. And there are a number of African-American people. As a matter of fact, one of the quotes that Richard Pryor gave Eddie Murphy a long time ago, I'm going to have to curse to make the point, because I don't usually curse. I don't like to go on record as cursing. But with Gus's permission, it's one four-letter word I want to use, and it's not S-H-I-T. But I remember when Eddie Murphy was talking about how Bill Cosby was talking about how he cursed too much in his routine. And Eddie Murphy was just complaining. He was telling Richard Pryor, he said, like, man, Richie, like, God, Cosby giving me a hard time, because he said, I curse too much in my routine. I just curse too much. And Richard said, Bill is telling you curse too much? He said, Mr. Jello? And Eddie said, yeah, he just keep cursing. He's telling me I'm cursing too much. I need to tone it down what I'm saying about children and how I talk about ladies and stuff like that. And Richard said, quote, you tell Bill that I said, eat some Jell-O, have a Coke, and shut the fuck up. Because you get paid doing what you do. Let Bill do what he does, and you do what you do. Now, the only reason I mentioned that to you and chose to curse and use that inflammatory language is to point out to you that I'm not suggesting that we should excuse the brother's behavior. I was suggesting that this is diversionary when you look at the amount of time. Okay, we're talking about something that happened probably repeatedly over and over again up to 2004 and probably even after 2004. But for them to pull out of their hat this one woman who happened to have now embraced the lifestyle of being a lesbian and use her as the primary person to bring down Heathcliff Huxtable, I'm telling you this diversionary. And I'm telling you this diversionary because I think Bill Cosby and one of his colleagues in the process of trying to buy a major network. And I think black folk have to learn how to look at the big picture. I'm not justifying or saying what the man did or allegedly did or was convicted of was right. I'm not even alluding to that. I'm just talking about how important it is for us to look at the big picture. I also want to point out that I know about Morgan Freeman and the whole nine yards and things that are going on around that. But when we identify certain people, and I think this was in response to Gus pointing out, and Gus, I'm going to jack you later on for muting my damn line. Gus was pointing out that he said we're talking about black misogyny. What did you say it was, Gus? What's the name of it again? The show that's coming to HBO?
Toxic Black Masculinity.
Yeah, toxic black masculinity. The fact that it's entitled toxic black masculinity is skewing the conversation, because I brought up again and pointed out that the person that has done this at a level that we should be discussing, we don't even touch. And I said the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and I drew on the reference, and he talked about grabbing a woman by the pee. You feel me? But we got to go back into 2004 and pull up a guy that was actually delivering babies on national TV for God knows how many years, and pull up on a guy that's probably now about 80% blind, you follow me, and use him as a poster boy to talk about toxic black masculinity. And Morgan Freeman, that's very symbolic, because you're talking about people that are clearly in the eye of the media invisible. Now, nobody is suggesting that they didn't pull up on those vanilla brothers that were in the media that did what they did. I'm saying to you, it's diversionary. I'm telling you, there are some bigger things going on in this country right now. Like when I made a reference about water, and Flint still, they still don't have their water situation together, right? We're talking about suicide and the lack of stability in a black family. I'm saying to you that there is something bigger going on. In no way am I trying to dilute or mute the fact that Cosby was convicted of what Cosby was convicted of. I'm just suggesting to people that you need to look at things in the context of the bigger picture. And I will reiterate with redundancy, I will no way, shape, fashion, or form include the history of things associated with R. Kelly, with Morgan Freeman, and Bill Cosby. But I welcome your comment. I think it was very informative, and it was definitely very, very insightful. And I didn't interpret anything that you said to sound like a feminist at all. And as a matter of fact,
well, I do want to make clear to Gus that I do apologize. I wasn't trying to accuse you of anything. I was just being a goober, I guess, but it wasn't an attack on you, and I apologize, and apologize to everybody. I'll mute my line.
Gus, what is a goober?
I didn't use the term, sir.
I don't know what a goober is. A goober I know is from old TV, which was Gomer Powell and Goober. No, I don't know what a goober is. All right, you feel me? Now, maybe I'm just illiterate. My Ebonics is getting rusty or something. But listen, brother, I'm a Jackie from muting my line. You're so funny. But your points are always valid and on point. And I love your candor and your assertiveness. You feel me? But I cannot overemphasize that black people need to get a little bit more in touch with brain inflammation, because cytokines can make your immune system go run amok. And like, if you're eating jacked up food or you're super stressed out, cortisol will dance around in your body and it create sort of like acute brain inflammation. And you could have a severe case of the flu that wind up with brain inflammation later on. You could even be constipated for a period of time and wind up with a general degree of brain inflammation and not even know it. So it's a reason why when black people used to say to folks stuff like, that person is in a bad mood, they would say, you're full of it. But then old people would say they act so much better when they go to the bathroom and have a movement. Because when you change the pH balance of your blood and make it more acidic, you're prone to have illnesses. And anytime you have any kind of illnesses, just think about yourself as heating up your brain. That's one of the reasons why they say when a person is really ill, your body temperature will increase. You run a fever. And if you keep the fever too long, it does what? People might hallucinate. They might talk out of their head, because your brain cannot tolerate having that damn high temperature, like 103 above, for a period of time. It's too much heat around the brain. The cerebral spinal fluid is getting too damn warm inside your damn head. One of the reasons why when people want to check out when you have a fever is they put the hand on your forehead and they want to check it out, right? Because when you get hot-headed, you don't think well. And there's some meaning to that, like this person is hot-headed. Your synapses are firing so fast in your brain, you don't know what's going on. And if you have a fever that runs high for too long, you can have a seizure, which means that you got a tremendous storm of synaptic activity going on inside of your brain, you know, because there's electrical activity there. So my love affair with the brain is directly related to the fact that the brain and the heart, they work like a team and they govern human behavior. And so when you look at heart disease and black people and the kinds of conditions that take us off the planet, strokes, i.e. related to heart disease and blood clots, be they emboli or thrombi, all those things can be related to stress, but invariably they're related to diet. You feel me? And again, my thesis, you cannot eat these people's food, and you need to be acutely aware of the kind of food that you're putting in your body, and you need to move around. You cannot sit around, be lethargic, and not move around and expect to be healthy. Nowhere in the world, because your body was designed to move around. So the reason why You have ball and socket joints at your shoulder and your hips because you're supposed to move your arms and move your legs, ambulate. You need to move around. And when doctors try to get you well, no matter what's happened to you in the hospital, unless you've had a severed spinal cord or like a major fracture on a limb, one of the first things the doctors say to you is we need to get you out of bed and we need to get you moving around. Because that gets the lymph moving around in your body. It allows the macrophages in your body to slough off stuff in your body that does not belong. It gets the blood circulating. It puts the life force back inside of you. And jacked up food, falling asleep late at night, looking at movies, that crap will give you a slow motion death and set the stage everything from colon cancer to diabetes. So, brother, I hope that you might have some more comments or some more questions that I might be able to share my 2 cents worth on before we go. And you know who I am. I'm always thinking, because some of the stuff that we talk about to me, it seems to be so lightweight and it doesn't seem to have the depth that I like to get to, but I want to make sure that I don't digress into language that's jargon to my craft, because it would be insulting to think that we could talk about a lot of technical things if I'm going to use a lot of language peculiar to neurophysiology and psychopharmacology of the brain, because most people know what the crap I'm talking about. You feel me? And it's probably less than in my craft of people that have PhDs. If you were to get together all the black PhDs that are dealing with the social sciences or biomedical sciences, it's probably less than 5% of all of us that have them that are in neuroscience in my discipline. You feel me? And a lot of us are so well trained that we think about rats in the laboratory. We don't really think about how these things translate into human behavior.
Always a pleasure to have Dr. Rasayan on the broadcast. His website, Eyes of Ma'at. .com, eyesofmaat.com. We got started for today's broadcast an hour earlier than we normally do. So this would be our 3-hour mark as we get ready to wrap things up. I'm sure we can make time, or hopefully Dr. Rasayan will make time to come back and chat with us again so we can continue the dialogue. I certainly appreciate all of your commentary and emphasis on the importance of diet. It seems like that touched on so many aspects of what we talked about today. As I said, I will drop you a line once I have seen Black Lightning to observe, get a comment, see if that stands out. Anything that you want to emphasize with listeners before we get ready to wrap things up?
At some point in the immediate future, we need to talk about that bloodline and the marriage of that sister to that prince. And we need to talk about her mother, who happened to have been a person to teach yoga for probably over 15 years, or at least 10 years.
Wow.
I'm talking about the royal wedding, all right?
Oh, yes, Meghan Markle, Prince Harry, absolutely.
Yeah, so at some point we can talk about what that really represents on the planet. And what's going on around that. You feel me? Because that's deeper than the average person thinks. It's a lot more than just a royal wedding. It's some things going on that directly relates to what's happening on this planet and the viability of humans on this planet in positions of power. But I just wanted to plant that seed in your head. And I also wanted to point out to you that it's always my honor and my pleasure to come and share my perspective and 2 cents worth with you. Because, I mean, nobody does what you do, and you are definitely an empath. You're a strong, resilient empath. And, brother, what you do needs to be done. It's a necessity. And I always just completely admire the way you amplify the spirit and the presence of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Because were not for Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, Carter G. Woodson would not have opened the door. Paul Robeson would not have opened the door. You feel me? Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, being a psychiatrist, riding on the knowledge that she basically sees from Nellie Fuller, set the stage for us to have the only person that was trained in Western science and medicine to point out the profound significance of us dealing with the system of racism and white supremacy. And I always applaud her spirit, and periodically I trip out a little bit when I think about the kinds of strokes that she is alleged to have had to take her off the planet when she left the planet, because that sister's physical incarnation is completely irreplaceable. We will never have another spirit with the kind of consciousness that Dr. Francis Quest Wilson has. Somebody that may amplify some of the things, but the consciousness and the strength and the resilience that she had, that sister's one of a kind. And we should always elevate her name.
Grandsister, Dr. Francis Crest Welsing, indeed. Pleasure is always ours. We will definitely have you back on the program as soon as we can make time. Dr. Rossayon, for listeners, you can visit the archives to hear some of the other broadcasts where Dr. Rossayon has been so gracious with his time and expertise. And you can visit the website, eyesofmaat.com, books, his blog, additional information. With that, again, we'll be here on Thursday, Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be back normal time. Thanks to all the folks who dialed in. Thanks, Princess, dialing in, commentary. If you have a gripe, guest suggestion, complaint, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Again, man, put that right up there with diet. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, given all of the toxins on the planet. Let's do everything. I know Dr. Welsing would strongly encourage. Let's do everything to preserve our brain computers working optimally so that we can figure out a final solution to the problem, our cosmic assignment, the system of white supremacy, replacing it with a system of justice. Certainly, in addition to being sober, if we're going to be out and about in a vehicle, let's buckle up every single time. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.